at Hawk's Head Show in the Lake District, so I do hope you can join me. Until then, I'm Kaz Graham. The producer is Sally Challoner, and Farming Today is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
And Farming Today will be back, of course, at the same time tomorrow. On FM, on digital, on smart speakers and BBC Sounds. This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 18th of August. This is Today with Henry Zeffman and Anna Foster.
The headlines this morning. A landmark trial begins in California today, which will see the tech giant Meta, owner of Facebook and Instagram, accused by 30 US states of fueling a mental health crisis in a generation of children. Critics say this is big tech's big tobacco moment.
It's a defective product, essentially. And so that's what these states are trying to prove through a variety of ways, by the way. But it's the first time, I think, they have these tech companies on the run.
Meta strongly disagrees. A court will decide. We'll hear both views during the programme. Moscow has warned the UK that its actions will have consequences after confirmation that Ukraine is using British-made drones to strike targets in Russia.
Also in today's programme, rain at last for large parts of the country that haven't seen it for weeks. But in Kent, there are still 8,000 people without water.
We have to go and get water from the bottle station. We buy it in the supermarket shop, you know. But you shouldn't have to buy water when you pay, you know, a decent amount of money for it to be one of your main utilities.
We have an exclusive report from Germany, now on the front line in the battle against small boats.
Big heavy metal doors. Oh, wow. This place is huge. And I'm looking at stacks and stacks of life jackets. They say they took more than 9,000 during this raid.
And we'll speak to an 88-year-old who's changing the game in the world of weightlifting. But before that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Alan Smith.
A jury trial which opens in California today could pose the biggest threat yet to the way Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, operates. There have always been some significant rulings in the US which found that the company had designed addictive products and endangered children on its platforms. This trial in Oakland is being brought by 30 states, which are claiming numerous violations of federal and state privacy laws for children, and by attorney generals from 4 states who say that Meta misled the public about the safety of its sites. The tech giant strongly denies the allegations. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
It's being called the largest consumer protection lawsuit in American history and stems from a complaint filed in 2023 by a coalition of U.S. states. They allege Meta incorporated harmful features on Instagram and Facebook to drive young user engagement in a bid to boost profits and then misled the public about it. Meta denies the allegations. It said it stood by its record of creating strong protections for teens and looked forward to making its case in court. The trial comes after some high-profile legal losses in similar cases. If Meta loses, the tech giant could face significant fines and be asked to make fundamental changes to the way young people experience social media, including ending like counts and infinite scroll.
Moscow has threatened the UK with consequences after it was confirmed that Ukraine had used British-made drones to strike targets inside Russia. Built by 2 separate British companies, the weapons were used as part of Kiev's intensified targeting of military and industrial facilities in Russia. Greg McKenzie reports.
Over the weekend, a military source confirmed to the BBC that British-made drones had been used to target Russian military and industrial sites, including fuel facilities. Last night, Moscow responded by accusing the UK of deliberately escalating the war in Ukraine. The Russian embassy in London described the UK as an accomplice in what it called bloody crimes and terrorist attacks, and warned that Britain's actions would have consequences. The Ministry of Defence said Britain stood shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine and remained committed to providing the equipment it needed to defend itself against what it called President Putin's illegal invasion.
Russian officials say that Ukraine has carried out another major attack overnight, launching more than 600 drones towards the Moscow region. 3 people are reported to have been injured. BBC Sport has been told that FIFA has sacked the senior executive who publicly criticised its president, Gianni Infantino, for planning to sell stakes in tournaments, including the World Cup. Kevin Lamour, the football governing body's chief operating officer, spoke out less than 3 weeks ago. Mr. Infantino later abandoned the scheme and apologised for errors. Here's our sports editor, Dan Rowan.
Last month, Kevin Lamour publicly condemned Gianni Infantino, the senior executive claiming that he and his FIFA colleagues had been deceived by their boss over the now abandoned FIFA Ford Enterprise project. At the time, the chief operating officer predicted that breaking ranks could result in his departure, adding that he had a duty of loyalty to his employer, but also to certain values. In a statement, FIFA would only confirm that Mr. Lamour had left, with staff told that the two parties had agreed to part ways after careful consideration.
The parents of at least 30 children have told the BBC they suspect they were given the wrong sperm or egg donations during IVF treatments in northern Cyprus. Fertility clinics in the Turkish-occupied territory are popular with British people who need medical help to have a baby but are loosely regulated. The BBC's latest investigation centres on one IVF clinic, as Anna Collinson reports.
Parents of seven children spoke in March of their fear that their chosen donor sperm or eggs weren't used in their IVF treatments. That number's now risen to 30 children. 11 have completed DNA tests. Charities say donor-conceived people have the right to know where they come from. The affected families are concerned they don't know their children's full medical history or whether they have unknown biological siblings. Many of the cases are linked to Doge IVF Centre. The owner hasn't responded to our questions, and neither has the Northern Cypriot government, which previously launched an investigation.
South East Water is warning some of its customers in Kent that their supplies may not return for another couple of days. Around 8,000 properties have no running water or are experiencing low water pressure. The company has blamed increased demand in recent hot weather as well as burst pipes and power issues. Former workers at the UK's newest prison have told the BBC of a chaotic atmosphere, saying it was understaffed and they received inadequate training. The interim director of HMP Millsike, New York, reportedly told a recent community meeting that recruitment for the site had been difficult. Mighty, which runs the jail, says safety is its highest priority and it's operating in line with plans agreed with the government. But Joe Chapman, who set up a support group for prisoners and employees, says that bosses should be more honest.
They're not fulfilling, as far as I'm concerned, the contract that they laid out at the beginning. They're trying, but at this moment in time, in my opinion, failing. Where I think they've gone wrong is by not being transparent with the prisoners and with the prisoners' families and even with their own staff about the difficulties that they're experiencing.
And around 1 million disabled people in England are to get free bus travel at any time of the day. Currently, disabled bus passes usually allow free travel only after 9:30 in the morning, unless councils choose to fund longer hours. From next April, ministers say those time limits will be removed, ending what they call a postcode lottery. Disability charities have welcomed the announcement, but the Conservatives have questioned how it will be funded.
Thanks, Alan. It's 6:07, which means it's time for the weather forecast. Over to Stav Danaos at the BBC Weather Centre.
Thank you very much. Good morning to you both. Well, today, for England and Wales, it's a cloudy start. A few light showers across southern England and northwest England through the morning. But as the day goes on, many of the showers will become confined to western coastal parts of England and Wales. And we will see cloud increase for many, with the best of any sunshine this afternoon reserved for southern parts of England. Now, temperatures for Wales, northern England, we're looking at 19 to 22 degrees, so a few degrees down on yesterday. Midland, southern and eastern England, 23 to 26. So still quite warm, maybe not quite as warm and humid as it was yesterday. Scotland, for you, it's a showery day, especially across western areas. Some of these will be heavy. Longer spells of rain will affect the northeast of Scotland and the Northern Isles. But eastern Scotland will see the best of any drier and brighter or sunnier breaks throughout the day. Temperatures across Scotland, 15 to 20 degrees. Northern Ireland, it's rather cloudy for you. Scattered showers to start with, particularly in the west. Eastern parts may have a better chance of seeing some brightness, although most of Northern Ireland will remain cloudy for much of the day. Temperatures, again, 15 to 20 degrees. Westerly winds will be moderate to fresh across the country today. Occasionally strong, though, towards the northwest of Scotland. Tonight, further showers and spells of mainly light to moderate rain will cross England and Wales. Again, it could be quite patchy in the south and the east. Scotland will stay showery with some heavy rain possible across northern Scotland again. And temperatures falling at 9 to 14 for many, but 16 or 17 again along southern England closer, feeling quite warm. Tomorrow and for the rest of the week, we'll continue to see cooler, more unsettled weather. Sunshine and blustery showers, some will be heavy and thundery, and nights will turn chillier as well.
Thank you, Stav. It's 9 minutes past six now. Let's take a first look at the front pages of this morning's papers. The I paper this morning has a plea from fire chiefs for people not to use 999 to report that a neighbour is holding a barbecue or having a bonfire. The paper says it comes in the wake of a surge of emergency calls over the weekend, which were blamed on the government's use of the national alert system to warn people about the dangers of starting a wildfire. It also reports a prediction from the Met Office that another heat wave will be the sixth this summer, maybe on its way next month.
Comments by the deputy leader of Reform UK on climate change are the main story for The Guardian. It reports that Richard Tice told a news conference it was arrogant to try to stop the climate emergency and encourage people to think about the upsides of heatwaves, like better British wine. The paper says his comments have caused a backlash from medical experts and green campaigners. The Mirror's headline declares Mr Tice a wine buffoon.
The Times carries a warning from the Children's Commissioner for England that children are becoming intoxicated by extremism. The comment comes from a report by Dame Rachel D'Souza, in which she says there's deep concern that young people are being drawn into radicalisation and violence, with the internet central to the process.
According to The Telegraph, the Housing Secretary, Angela Rayner, has softened planning rules for travellers' sites, which would give councils fewer ways to block them. The paper says she's removed two rules which councils and residents had been able to use to oppose unauthorised camps. But it quotes government sources who argue that other changes will make it harder for such sites to get retrospective planning permission.
And The Times this morning reports that a study suggested a shared fondness for a particular music genre or artist may reveal more about a couple's compatibility than other personality traits. Researchers in Austria mixed up real couples to test the idea and found that those who were a pair were much more alike in what they listened to on average than people who were put together at random. The leader of the study said it was her hunch that musical preferences combine several clues at once about a person's personality traits, emotional tendencies, values and background.
It's 11 minutes past six.
Russia has accused the UK of deliberately escalating the war in Ukraine after British-made drones were used by Ukraine to strike targets inside Russia. The accusation came from the Russian embassy in London. Damian Grammaticus is our political correspondent. Damian, before we hear more about what the embassy said, tell us a bit about these drones.
So these, Anna, are two UK companies manufacturing drones, which have been part of a package of support that the UK has been giving to Ukraine. And particularly earlier this year, it was announced by the MOD that they would be supplying tens of thousands of drones, including long-range strike ones. That was the largest ever support package. We're I think, into $25 billion worth of pounds worth of support for Ukraine. And these are things that are targeting sites such as fuel depots, those large warehouses, the Amazon-style warehouses in Ukraine, in Russia, that Ukraine has been targeting because they're involved in military supplies, also logistics sites, military sites. So I think what many are seeing is that these strikes are bringing the war very much to new parts of Russia, closer to Moscow, closer to and more impacts on Russian people themselves feeling the effects of the war. So it's certainly helping to ramp up the pressure.
Mm. And tell us, Damian, what Russia has said via the embassy in London, but also I think we've heard from the UK Ministry of Defence as well.
Yes, we have. So this is overnight in response to those reports that these UK drones had been used for the first time. So what the embassy here has said is that London, it says, is opting for an escalation of the Ukrainian crisis. You said the UK is acting as accomplice, seeking to contain Russia, inflict maximum damage on it by proxy, and those actions will inevitably carry consequences for which London will have to answer. Now, the MOD in response has said that Britain stands shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine. We're committed to providing the equipment Ukraine needs to defend itself, the MOD said. Russia should be in no doubt about the resolve of the government. And I think it's worth remembering here that these packages, I mean, these were drones, this was agreed under Keir Starmer. He, on his last day, visited Kyiv and promised support. Andy Burnham, his first foreign minister, foreign visitor after he became Prime Minister was President Zelensky. Andy Burnham said at Downing Street that he was with Ukraine 100%, and he said to President Zelensky, "I'm personally with you. I will honour every commitment the country has made." And there is also a history of Russia making these kinds of threats. So over, remember, Challenger tanks or Storm Shadow missiles, Russia has always been critical. Many see that as an attempt by Russia to shape the UK's actions in response, or try to limit the UK's responses supporting Ukraine. And Russia has already carried out actions in the UK, including not so long ago, two men convicted of firebombing locations linked to Keir Starmer. So there is considerable tension already in the relationship, but this is ramping it up.
Damian Grammaticus, thank you.
It's 14 minutes past six. Britain's newest prison was supposed to be a model for the future. HMP Millsike in East Yorkshire opened just over a year ago, with ministers promising a state-of-the-art jail focused on rehabilitation and helping to ease the prison overcrowding crisis. But a BBC investigation has uncovered claims from former staff of a prison struggling to find its feet, with concerns about training, staffing levels and safety inside the jail. Well, Louise Fuster from BBC Yorkshire has the story. Louise, what have you found?
Well, Millsike Prison is the UK's newest jail, and it opened in March 2025 to very much excitement. Siobhan McMood was just his secretary then, and she said it would set the standard for the future. Now, it has capacity for 1,500 spaces, so it's a big part of the solution for the current state of prison overcrowding, but also focuses on prisoner rehabilitation. Now, a lot has happened since it opened, though, including around concerns about staffing levels. I've been told, the interim director told a meeting of residents in June, that recruitment had been difficult, with as many as 90% of staff never having worked in the prison sector.
And what do the company running the prison have to say about all of this?
So it's a privately run prison run by a company called Mighty. It's their first prison that they're running. It said everyone who needed dojo training had received it. Mighty also told us that safety was their highest priority and that the prison maintained a safe, secure and supportive environment for prisoners, colleagues and visitors. It also said that recruitment and training aligned to the prison's phased growth and that it recruits from other backgrounds, not just the prison sector, but also sectors such as the military and other areas of the criminal justice network.
So that's Mighty who are running the prison. What's the government's role in this, Louise?
Well, the government made the decision to award the contract to Mighty to run it. Now, the Minister of Justice told me it had gone through a robust procurement process before making that decision and that it would act when standards fall short.
Louise Fuster from BBC Yorkshire Investigations, thank you very much.
Just coming around 17 minutes past six, the cost of long-term borrowing for the United States has hit its highest level for 19 years. Sean's got more on that and the rest of the day's business news as well. Morning, Sean.
Hi, Anna. Yes, this has been a bit of a theme for a lot of bond prices, bond yields, the cost of borrowing for governments around Europe and in the United States as well. But notably, the US hitting those levels it's not seen for almost two decades when it looks at the cost of borrowing over a 30-year period. I've got Rachel Winter with me, who's partner and investment manager at Killick & Co. Morning, Rachel. Good morning, Rachel. Do we have Rachel on the line? Maybe not. We will jump to Rachel.
Good morning, Sean.
Hi, Rachel. Yes, we've got you. Good morning, Rachel. So we've talked quite a lot, you know, in recent times, higher oil prices, higher potential costs being passed on to households and businesses around the UK. What has happened of late that has meant the US government is seeing its highest borrowing levels over that period for 19 years?
Well, part of it is due to inflation and inflation expectations. So interest rates and therefore borrowing costs are very much determined by inflation. When inflation is higher or expected to rise, then governments generally need to raise borrowing costs in order to get that inflation under control. Because of the situation in the Middle East and the fact that that is expected to continue, we are seeing a rise in inflation expectations, and that has led to higher borrowing costs.
So has something changed in recent months? Because, you know, many, you know, hearing this section of the programme for many months will have heard how oil prices have been higher for longer than people might have thought. Even though we've fallen and bounced back, we're still talking about a barrel of Brent crude being over $90 a barrel this morning. So what is it about what's happened that has meant those interest rate expectations are now higher than they, those inflation and price rise expectations are now higher than they once were?
I think you've got a lack of confidence now that we are going to have a quick resolution in the Middle East. For example, this week you've had Donald Trump saying he's going to bomb Oman. So I think that has led to some concerns. You've also got a number of other factors feeding into these borrowing costs. So as I said, inflation is definitely a big factor. Another one that has had an impact in the last couple of weeks is Japan. So Japan is actually the biggest holder of US government bonds. And there is a concern that Japan might look to sell some of those to raise money to buy the yen, to prop up the value of the yen. And if Japan sells US government bonds, that will have the impact of raising the yield or the borrowing cost for US government debt.
And what about how these governments are going about handling their finances? So, you know, the cost of borrowing for the UK government over a 10-year period, that 10-year bond that we'd often look at, is back over 5% in recent days. France's 10-year borrowing has been at its highest level since 2009. Is there something that investors aren't convinced about in terms of the financial decisions those countries are making themselves, their spending levels, their borrowing levels, their prospects for growth?
Yes, I think that's a part of it. So if we take the UK as an example, we had that comment from Andy Burnham last year when he said that we shouldn't be in a hock to bond markets. And that led to some concern that he might try and borrow huge amounts if he were to become the prime minister. So I think that comment is still having an impact in what's happening to bond yields or government bond prices here in the UK.
And will that mean people are going to be watching, you know, the jobs figures that we'll be getting out after 7 o'clock this morning, the inflation, official inflation figures that are coming the UK's way in the coming days as well? Could they
Definitely.
Have a bit of an impact on, you know, the prospects for the UK economy and where people think interest rates might go next?
Exactly. So we've got the jobs data this morning. If that shows that the UK labour market is weak, then that suggests that interest rates might need to come down in order to prop up the economy. On the other hand, if we get the inflation data slightly later in the week and that is higher than expected, then maybe interest rates and therefore borrowing costs will need to remain high in order to keep that inflation under control. So the Bank of England really does have a very difficult job in deciding what the interest rate should be.
I just want to bring Adrian Ash in on this conversation, Director of Research at Bullion Vault, with a bit of a focus on the gold price this morning, Adrian. Morning to you. It's risen by over 10% in the last month. So an ounce of gold now around $4,400. Earlier in the year, we were talking about it being $5,600. How much of what Rachel's describing there has contributed to rises in gold in recent weeks?
Well, certainly the rebound in gold, as you say, Sean, it's up 10% over the past month or so, I think has really come as long-term doubts about the sustainability of particularly Western government debt have come to the fore. As Rachel said, you've had data recently in the US in particular, which has actually been quite soft on inflation, on jobs as well. And that's put a question mark over the assumption, which a lot of people have had, which that the US Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates. So as those expectations have faded, gold has rallied. Also, though, you know, to see gold rallying like this at the same time as long-term interest rates in the bond market have been going higher, I think that really does speak to this deeper concern, this long-term concern about the viability of Western government policy on debt.
But how is this rise that we've seen in recent weeks different to what felt like a crazy, relentless rise in the price of gold earlier this year?
This is much more measured. I mean, often you see the gold price take a lull over the summer. India, the second largest consumer after China, there's basically no auspicious dates on Hindu calendars for weddings over the summer, so Indian demand goes basically silent. Financial markets tend to be a little bit softer as well, and gold often will set a kind of summer low early on, sometime around June. We hit the low at the very end of June this year, below $4,000, as you say. We've now come up 10%. But yeah, I mean, we're a long way off the, frankly, the kind of mania speed of appreciation that we saw at the new year.
Given the massive volatility, you know, almost like some of the volatility and bouncing around in prices we talk about in the crypto world that we've talked about in gold this year, do you see people sort of acting sooner? You say there are no sort of major holidays in the Hindu calendar at the moment, but are people now more sensitive to potential much higher prices and so acting almost with gold for the longer term?
Very much so. I mean, it's interesting with particularly the giant consumer markets in China and India. What you've seen is as prices have risen over the past couple of years, people are actually shifting their consumption demand away from jewelry and towards investment products, whether that's coins, particularly bars in the Far East, but also gold-backed ETFs, products such as bullion vault, you know, digital gold on a phone app. And that really, I think, speaks to people wanting to own gold and wanting to own it for the long term, but wanting to do it in a more efficient way. So right. You're paying lower costs than if you were buying jewellery.
Adrian, thank you. Adrian Ash there from Bullion Vault, Rachel Winter from Killick & Co. A major theme of Andy Burnham's tenure so far has been council housing. He first pledged the biggest council house building programme since the post-war period. This week we've heard his government announce that loosening of planning rules to encourage developments near train and tram stations. Are social housing associations ready and in a position to build on that, though? Claire Miller is chief executive of Clarion Housing Group, the largest housing association in the UK. So we've got 125,000 properties across 170 local authorities. Claire, good morning. Is your sector poised?
We certainly are. Good morning, Sean. What we're waiting for at the moment is confirmation of the government's allocation of its commitment of £39 billion. Which is the Social and Affordable Housing Programme. And that commitment is over 10 years.
When do you expect that to come?
Hopefully any day now. The sooner it comes, the sooner we can get going and start building. Of course, what we're also waiting for is confirmation of the grant rates. And that is the amount of capital subsidy we get per home that we build. As you said, the Prime Minister is very keen to build social housing. Those are the most expensive homes because they charge the lowest rent.
But when you see, sorry to interrupt you there, Claire. I just wonder when you see, you know, the latest announcements of loosening of planning rules near train and tram stations, is that having a material difference on your ability, your timelines you have now compared to, say, a few weeks ago of when you can get this stuff built?
Not yet, but I mean, all loosening of planning regulations is welcome news for those of us who build lots of homes. Clarion built 1,500 homes last year.
We've heard not yet for quite a while now, though, haven't we? This planning chat, you know, started a couple of years ago.
Building new homes is complicated in the UK. Planning is one element of it. The other elements, of course, are the funding and the long-term cost of building new homes, but also securing sites that are viable for social housing can also be a challenge.
What about workers? Is the workforce there to build as quickly as some of the targets are, even if we, you know, eventually get the not yet actually happening and the planning and the regulations around it are loosened to enable other things to fall into place? Is the workforce there?
Well, that again is a challenge. But, you know, housing associations work very closely with the commercial house builders, with local authorities, with a range of different stakeholders. And we are all doing our best to invest in the skills for the future.
Maybe doing your best, but I just wonder, is it there? Is it ready? Like, for all the announcements and the headlines, you know, the positivity, you know, 2 years later, we're still hearing from the house building sector that, you know, things haven't quite fallen into place. And here we are again, sort of saying we're doing our best, but is the best good enough at the minute to build houses that we need?
I think we are all investing in skills for the future. But of course, you know, construction, like every other industry, is facing a number of headwinds. And, you know, there will be challenges and changes to the way in-house building takes place in the future. And we need to anticipate some of those changes.
Claire, thank you for your time this morning. Claire Miller there, Chief Executive of Clarion Housing Group. I will be back after seven with those latest jobs market figures. Interesting ones to see what's happening with employment and unemployment at the moment.
Look forward to speaking then, Sean. It's 28 minutes past six, and here's Carthy with the sports news.
Morning. Thank you very much. The opening round of fixtures of the new Championship season came to an end with a dramatic one-all draw between Welsh rivals Cardiff City and Wrexham. A 98th-minute goal from Reuben Colwell salvaged a point for Cardiff City as the two Welsh sides met in the league for the first time in just under 25 years. FIFA's chief operating officer, Kevin Lamour, has been sacked by the sports governing body less than 3 weeks after he strongly criticised the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino's aborted plan to sell stakes in competitions, including the World Cup, to private investors. England's men's cricketers start their first test without Ben Stokes as captain and Brendan McCullum as the England coach tomorrow when they face Pakistan. England will be led by interim coach Marcus Drescothic, with Joe Root in a second stint as test captain. Jordan Cox is part of the new-look England side. He'll be batting at number three.
It's so enjoyable playing for England. You know, we've got Trez as head coach for the time being. Flem will then come. Look, it's awesome for Test cricket. You know, it's awesome for English cricket, and we're all looking forward to it.
Tennis, and Great Britain's Arthur Ferry, playing in his first tournament since reaching the semi-finals at Wimbledon, has been knocked out of the Cincinnati Open in the third round by the fifth seed Alex de Minaur. Serena and Venus Williams played their first doubles match together since 2022 at the Cincinnati Open. The sisters lost a third set tiebreak to go out in the first round to Marta Kostyuk and Peyton Stearns. 44-year-old Serena Williams is back playing competitively, and 45-year-old Roger Federer will be back on court at the US Open, this time next week. Not competitively, though. The 20-time major champion will be on court in New York for the first time since 2019, playing in an exhibition match. Federer's agent, Tony Godsick, explains why the 45-year-old is back.
Roger will definitely not be pulling a Serena Williams, but Roger did, after he retired, wanted to make sure his body could heal a little bit and his knees were okay. And I think he misses playing tennis. He doesn't miss the training and the butterflies in his stomach before a big match. But no, the USTA reached out and said, look, Roger, you know, won five consecutive US Open titles. We never properly celebrated him. We'd like to do a night where he can play maybe some singles, and that might happen against Andy Roddick, and he'll play some doubles with Roddick and Agassi and someone, you know, another player. And Roger said, yeah, I'd love to do it.
And LIV Golf has cancelled next week's team championships in Michigan, saying it needs to focus on building its next chapter. This week's event in Indianapolis will now be the last LIV tournament of the season. The breakaway league has faced an uncertain future since Saudi Arabia withdrew its financial backing in April.
Thank you, Cathy.
December 1988. A plane takes off from Heathrow Airport. 38 minutes later...
I was just driving home, you know, and then this flash of flames.
A Libyan man was convicted of murdering 270 people, but that wasn't the end.
I would imagine Lockerbie has spawned more conspiracy theories than any other human event.
Now, in light of fresh evidence and a new trial, we look again at what happened, leading us to militant groups and global politics. Intrigue, Lockerbie. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
The time is 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Henry Zeffman. And now a summary of the news from Charles Carroll.
A major jury trial gets underway in California today, with 30 US states accusing Meta of deliberately designing some of its platforms to be addictive to young users. If the technology giant, which owns Facebook and Instagram, loses, it may have to pay upwards of $1 trillion in damages. Meta strongly denies the allegations and says it stands by its record of creating strong protection for teens. Moscow has threatened the UK with consequences after it was confirmed that Ukraine had used British-made drones to strike targets inside Russia. The Russian embassy in London accused Britain of deliberately escalating the war in Ukraine. The British government says that it remains committed to supplying Ukraine with the equipment it needs to defend itself. BBC Sport has been told that FIFA has sacked the senior executive who publicly criticised its president, Gianni Infantino, for planning to sell stakes in tournaments, including the World Cup. Kevin Lamour, the football governing body's chief operating officer, spoke out less than 3 weeks ago. Mr. Infantino later abandoned the scheme. Former workers at the UK's newest prison have told the BBC of a chaotic atmosphere, saying that it was understaffed and they received inadequate training. A specialist team, which deals with the most serious incidents, was called to HMP Millsike near York 7 times in its first 9 months. Mighty, which runs the jail, says it's operating in line with expectations. South East Water is warning some of its customers in Kent that their supplies may not return for another couple of days. Around 8,000 properties have no running water or are experiencing low water pressure. The company has blamed increased demand in the recent hot weather, as well as burst pipes and power issues. And around 1 million disabled people in England are to get free bus travel at any time of the day. Currently, disabled bus passes usually allow free travel only after 9:30 in the morning, unless councils choose to fund longer hours. From next April, ministers say those time limits will be removed. The Conservatives have questioned how it will be funded.
Thank you, Charles. It's 26 minutes to seven. A major court case against Meta begins today. Before a jury in California, a group of US states will argue that the parent company of Facebook and Instagram has deliberately designed its products to be addictive for young users. Lily Jamali is our North America technology correspondent and joins us now. Great to have you with us, Lily. Who's bringing this case and what do they want to achieve?
Well, thanks for having me on. This is a case brought by dozens of U.S. states. The complaint was first filed in 2023, so it's been a couple of years in the making, this trial. And they allege that Meta incorporated harmful features on its major platforms, so Instagram and Facebook. They allege that these features, things like infinite scroll and likes and push notifications, were designed in a way to drive engagement among young users, all with the goal of boosting their profits. And not only that, they allege that the company then lied to the public about what they were doing. So they are going to spend the next 6 weeks, these states led by California, Colorado, New Jersey, and Kentucky, laying out their case. Meta calls the claims unsubstantiated. They, as we heard just a moment ago, you know, say that they have a record of trying to create some safety protections for teen users. And they also say they're being penalized for issues that are very, you know, common in the tech industry, things like age verification. So they think that the states are coming at them for things that are quite widespread and quite problematic for a whole host of companies.
So what would happen if Meta lost?
So there is the possibility of a major payout. We've heard the number north of $1 trillion shared, but we are not at that point yet. I think what the states are really pushing for is meaningful change to the features that I just laid out. So something that will prompt this judge, who is going to be given an advisory verdict by the jury that was seated last week, that will prompt the judge to compel Meta to change these features, to make them less addictive to these young users. If they're able to compel that, I think the states will think that they really walked away with a victory in hand.
Lily Jamali, our North America technology correspondent, thank you for joining us.
It's 24 minutes to seven. Russia says it downed 180 of 620 drones fired towards it by Ukraine overnight. Another of the online retailer Wildberries warehouses has been hit near Moscow. It is another example of Ukraine's changing and developing tactics, now favouring targets deep inside Russia to have an impact on people living there. Ukraine's deputy chief of military intelligence, Vadim Sibitsky, has been speaking to the BBC, describing their ambition inside Russian territory.
We should destroy and disrupt, first of all, production, weaponry. And that is why one of the main targets, main object for us is defense industry. And of course, next one, logistics system, including in some case, Wildberries, for example. Why? Because it's one of the element of the logistics system of Russian Federation to wage the war, including, for example, through Wildberries, some military equipment, military components, and another element that Russia Federation uses for war.
Well, Vadim Sibitsky was speaking to our Kyiv correspondent, Dan Johnson. What he describes there, Dan, is something that we are seeing now regularly every day overnight.
Yes, it feels like every night another Wildberries warehouse is hit. There's another one burning close to Moscow this morning. And the deputy chief of Ukrainian intelligence feels that those strikes are justified because of the role he believes Wildberries is playing in supplying Russia's military. So he confirmed to me that those sort of deep, long-range drone strikes would continue, targeting not just those distribution warehouses, but also oil refineries, transport networks, and naval bases too. And he told me that he feels that is being effective effective, first of all in disrupting Russia's military supply chains, but also in affecting the mindset of the Russian people. He told me there is intelligence that the attitudes are hardening towards the Kremlin and the war that it is waging against Ukraine, partly because of the military losses, the lack of success that Russia can claim, but also the impact this is having on ordinary life for Russians, their prosperity and their standard of living.
And what about ordinary life for Ukrainians, Dan? Is that something that they feel that they are in any way seeing the benefit of?
Well, they believe that these strikes are successful, but in terms of what Russia is able to do in attacking Ukraine, there is still an enormous risk. We've seen at least 5 deaths overnight in drone strikes across the country. The ballistic missile threat that Russia poses to Ukraine is still very much alive. And I thought when I asked the Major General what he considered to be the biggest threat, he might raise the lack of Patriot interceptor missiles. He acknowledged that shortage and that problem, but he actually said he thought the biggest threat was the misery that Russia would inflict on the Ukrainian people in the forthcoming winter. Last winter was very, very difficult for people here. It was cold, the heating was knocked out, the power was off, there wasn't light at times. And the Major General said he could foresee that happening again and that people would suffer even more, even with disruption to the clean running water supply. So he said his focus now was on trying to build intelligence to try to prevent those attacks. But he did highlight that Ukraine has a shortage of the sort of weapons it needs, not just to defend its skies here across Ukraine, but also to attack the sites in Russia that are used to launch the missiles towards this country.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Johnson there in Kyiv. Worth saying as well, you heard Damian Grammaticus earlier in the programme describing this Russian threat against the UK. This is Moscow's embassy in London, saying that because UK-made drones are being used in some of those strikes on Russia that Dan was talking about there, that London's actions, in the words of the embassy, will inevitably have consequences. Well, I've been speaking to Andrei Fedorov, who's a former deputy foreign minister of Russia. He's an advisor to the current Russian administration. He has some interesting views on that. He says he can envisage a situation in which Russia would consider striking the UK. We'll hear what he has to say in just under an hour's time.
It's 20 to 7.
Now, let's turn our attention to the Middle East, because the Israeli Prime Minister's office says the Board of Peace, the US-backed group tasked with achieving the job of peace and reconstruction in Gaza, has agreed that Hamas disarmament and the demilitarization of the Strip should happen before Israel withdraws its forces from there. That is a different outlook to the original plan, which had both sides completing their commitment in stages as part of a phased withdrawal. Yolande Nel is our Middle East correspondent. Yolande, what this does do is raise broader questions about Donald Trump's long-term peace plan and how it might move forward.
That's right. And, you know, Israeli media are picking up on this crucial part of the deal, really sort of the definite change in language that there has been, with sources speaking to Israeli media saying that the Board of Peace is considering abandoning this phased framework for Hamas's disarmament because of the Israeli pushback that there has been. Israel has been demanding a full and genuine disarmament before any troops leave Gaza. And so sources are saying that instead of having Hamas hand over its weapons in stages, with Israel then conducting corresponding withdrawals, Hamas would have to hand over all of its weapons throughout Gaza, and only then would Israel go back to the Gaza border. Now, I mean, of course, that shift could be enough to get Israel on board, which it hasn't been so far. But of course, at the same time, it would risk losing the support of Hamas, let alone other Palestinian armed groups that Hamas has to bring along as well. And this took absolute months of very complicated negotiations to get Hamas to this point. And there is one commentator in the Israeli newspapers this morning, in Mariv newspaper, saying the American negotiating team headed by Jared Kushner made a rookie mistake in the past 2 days. It gave Prime Minister Netanyahu precisely what Israel needed, a way to wiggle out of the Gaza ceasefire, demilitarization and reconstruction agreement, because it's also being said that there will be no reconstruction before disarmament's completed.
Which is a key issue, isn't it? And those problems that you highlight there, Yoland, despite that, Jared Kushner is saying that progress could begin quite quickly.
Yes, he gave a very positive-sounding interview with Fox News, talking about how within 30 days, as little as that, hopefully there would be some weapons taken out of Gaza, and then in the next 60 to 90 days, filling in some of the tunnels as well. there have been working groups that have been set up, one on disarmament and one on sanitation and public health issues. So he is trying to portray these 2 days of talks as keeping President Trump's bigger vision for Gaza going, despite the fact it has really appeared to stall this US plan since the October ceasefire last year. Israel's continued to carry out strikes. It seized more territory in Gaza. There have been restrictions on many kinds of humanitarian supplies that were expected to go in. Hamas, up to now, has been refusing to give up its weapons and has been reasserting its authority on the ground.
Yolande Nell, our Middle East correspondent, thank you.
At 17 minutes to seven, for years, sheep farmers could barely give wool away. Some even burned fleeces because selling them wasn't worth the cost. But now the market has turned dramatically, with wool prices up more than 70% in the past year as global stockpiles run low. Howell Griffith sent us this report from the Royal Welsh Agricultural Show.
On stand number three, Queen Lion, up the neck, round behind you, Jeff and Lewis, your local man from just up the road in Riga, right on his tail.
As spectator sports go, competitive sheep shearing may not be mainstream, but it always draws a crowd at the annual Royal Welsh Agricultural Show. This year, the sheep farmers visiting had reason to be cheerful. The money they receive for each fleece has been rising. On average, it's up 70% on last year. According to Gareth Jones from British Wool, it's part of a commodity boom shaped by international supply and demand.
If we look at the global markets, there's less sheep in Wales, less sheep in the UK producing less wool. But if we look at a comparable market to us, like New Zealand, there's less sheep in New Zealand now, and they also had a carryover of wool since COVID. That's cleared in the last 2 years now. So the limited supply that we have, including the increased demand, is increasing, obviously, the competition in the auction, which farmers are going to see the benefits of that.
And where's that demand coming from?
So we see it in the domestic market. So 50% of our wool stays here in the UK. We have 180 brands who are working with us, who are specifying British wool in their products. But we also have China, which is an important market for us. We also have a bedding manufacturer in South Korea. And also we have some licensees in Japan. So it's very much here in Wales, we're producing a fantastic fibre, but it's in demand worldwide.
Come on.
On his farm in the hills above Llanfair Cyreinion in Mid Wales, Wyn Williams keeps a flock of around 700 sheep. He's been here for the last 38 years, rearing mainly for meat. Yeah. But what he gets for the wool makes a real difference.
Well, it helps to cover the costs. You know, we've got shearers coming in, they're professional shearers, experienced. It's not everybody that can shear, you know, and also, you know, your helpers, you know, the wool wrappers and everything. It assists with the cost of the... And most importantly, we have to shear us from an animal welfare and health perspective. You know, who would want to... big strong winter coat still on with the excessive heat that we've got at the moment.
Wool has been spun in Britain since the Bronze Age, and while technology's changed over the centuries, the process of sorting through each fleece is still done by hand.
Four is a mule, five is a luster, which is your best types of wool.
At a depot in Newtown, Barry Bellis says he can recognise 68 different grades of wool, from the finest destined for knitwear to the coarser kind that could end up in carpets or even slug pellets.
If you've got a nice white fleece like that one, you're able to dye that pink, green, blue, whatever colour you want. So there's more value to this fleece than there is this one. The blue-face Leicester fleece, which is our closest to the merino, that will go into like men's knitwear, so like your suits and stuff like that. Whereas this type of fleece, because it contains some Kemp, because it's a Welsh mule, that will tend to go into a carpet blend and stuff like that because of the colour.
He goes in for his final lantern.
Back at the shearing sheds, competition for the prize is fierce. Rising wool prices aren't necessarily good news for shoppers, of course, but they do offer reward for one of Britain's oldest industries.
Give a big hand, ladies and gentlemen. Out goes Jessica Lewis.
As Howell Griffiths reporting, it's 13 minutes to 7. China's leader Xi Jinping has used a major speech overnight to honour Jiang Zemin, the man who took charge after the Tiananmen Square crackdown and oversaw China's economic rise. He was speaking, Xi Jinping, at an event to commemorate the centennial of Jiang Zemin's birth. He led China between 1993 and 2002. But by celebrating a leader associated with market reform and an open economy, she's also revived memories of an era that many Chinese remember as more optimistic and prosperous than today. So at a time when China's economy is under pressure, what was she trying to say? Well, Kerry Brown is Professor of Chinese Studies at King's College London, also used to be the Foreign Office's first secretary in Beijing. Kerry, good morning. Just give us an idea of what you think the broader message in this speech might have been.
Yeah, Jiang Zemin was a very surprising choice to lead the party. The Tiananmen Square crackdown had happened in 1989, and the leader then, Zhao Ziyang, was removed and placed under house arrest. And Jiang Zemin was sort of brought from Shanghai, where he was the party boss there, working with a man called Zhu Rongji, who only died a couple of days ago. And Jiang basically stabilized China, but he also recommitted to reform. That's the important thing. So, you know, there was a fear at the time. I remember very well that China might kind of turn its back on the world and become isolated again. But Jiang Zemin, with the help of Deng Xiaoping, the paramount leader who was still alive then, you know, recommitted to openness to the world when there were kind of huge pressures. And so he took China towards entry to the World Trade Organization and built the economic foundations that Xi Jinping is able to enjoy today, even though they're very different leaders.
Mm. And just going back through Chinese history, I think this is interesting because there are times when Chinese leaders have sought to completely erase eras and policies and moments in history that have gone before them. So what do you think was behind Xi's thinking here, particularly when you look at the situation that he faces now and the difficulties and challenges that he perhaps faces with the economy?
I think that Xi Jinping is aware that it's the party first. The party is the thing that has to make its, you know, one, you know, kind of its monopoly on power sustainable. They overtook the USSR. Kind of, they were 74 years in power. Well, China has now got a party that's been, you know, more than 75, 76 years in power. So it's broken the record that was set by the USSR. And I think there's this sort of sense that, look, we're basing our legitimacy not on one leader, even though she gets a lot of attention now, but on the party corporately. And it's got to be about the party. And I think that's really one of the messages of his speech yesterday, that the party is sort of eternal. You know, it's like the Catholic Church in a way. It has to go on and on and on. And that he is a great leader. Jiang Zemin was a great leader. Mao Zedong was a great leader. But they were great leaders because they were leading a great party. So I think that's part of the messaging.
When we look at those reforms that Jiang Zemin was responsible for, to what extent has Xi wound them back?
Well, Xi is a more conservative leader in a strange way. I mean, Jiang Zemin and Zhu Rongji, his premier from 1998, were really reformists and they took big risks. They took on the state enterprise system. 60 million people were laid off at the time. I mean, huge costs. But they created this entrepreneurialism, the non-state sector at the time got more and more powerful. And, you know, kind of they took a lot of risks. Xi Jinping has been pretty remorseless in, you know, stressing the discipline of the party, stressing the sort of need for the party to be very, very cohesive, and has been pretty tough on the non-state sector, you know, the entrepreneurs, people like Jack Ma of Alibaba. So in that sense, they're kind of instinctively quite different leaders. And they're leaders at different times because, you know, Xi Jinping is leading a kind of country which is the world's second biggest economy, huge challenges with the United States, very, very kind of clear that China is now almost feared in the world because of its power. Whereas under Jiang Zemin, it wasn't as formidable. It was still rising rather than risen.
Mm. Really interesting insights. Thank you for being with us this morning, Professor Kerry Brown.
It's 8 minutes to 7.
Disabled people in England will be able to travel by bus for free at any time of day from April, the government has announced. Currently, disabled bus passes can only be used for free travel between 9:30 in the morning and 11 o'clock at night on weekdays, making it difficult for people to get to work or attend later evening events. They can be used at any time of the day, at the weekend and on bank holidays. Well, to discuss this new policy, we're joined by a Government Minister at the Department for Work and Pensions, Lillian Greenwood. Thank you very much for joining us, Lillian Greenwood. One of the motivations for doing this is to help disabled people get to work. About 550,000 disabled people are currently unemployed. Is there a certain number that you hope will be able to get into work as a result of this change?
Look, we want to get more disabled people into work. Too many people are kind of trapped in a life on benefits, whereas we want to give them the opportunities that work brings. Obviously, this is only a very small part of that. But we know that that buses are a lifeline for people. They make it, obviously, they connect people to work, to training, to education, as well as to friends and family and social opportunities. And so this is one change that we can make that can help people, disabled people, to get out and about, to connect them to those opportunities, and also give them that vital breathing space at a time when the cost of living, we know, is a worry for people.
Just to pin down a specific about this change, it's funded to the tune of £60 million by reallocation of existing budgets. Is this just a policy for 1 year when it takes effect in April, or is it an indefinite commitment?
No, it's an indefinite commitment. Changing the time for use of a disabled bus, disabled person's bus pass requires a change in legislation. We're not intending to change this. Obviously, we'll have to find our funding for within the spending review for future years. But there's we've already reallocated funding within our budgets this year to deliver this from the 1st of April next year.
OK, I know you're a work and pensions minister, but you were a transport minister until a few weeks ago, and you were previously the chair of the Select Committee on Transport in the House of Commons. So I just wanted to ask you about accessibility more broadly, across transport more broadly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was looking at House of Commons library data, which suggests that about one in five train stations in Britain still don't have a ramp for wheelchair users to access trains. Is there a case that this money would be better spent making sure that all travel is accessible?
Well, look, we absolutely need to make more of our public transport system accessible. We've heard many times that it doesn't work for people, and we want it to work for everyone. And I know that the Select Committee, not in my time, but in under its current chair, Ruth Cadbury, did a significant report on this. And obviously, my colleague Simon Lightwood, who leads on accessibility issues within the Department for Transport, I know has responded to that and is working on a charter to improve disability access for people. And of course, we are doing that. There's work ongoing to try to tackle some of those problems that you've highlighted.
Let me just put a specific to you, because the more than £1 million investment going into the new Old Oak Common station, the biggest new station in Europe, going to be a huge part of HS2 when it happens. There isn't even there a guarantee of level boarding for wheelchair users throughout the station. A new modern station at the centrepiece of a government's flagship transport policy, isn't that extraordinary?
Well, look, whenever we make changes to our rail network, obviously, you know, when we're trying to make sure things operate on both new stations and existing stations, sometimes that means compromises, because we're working on a network that's, 200 years old this year. But of course, we want to maximise the accessibility of all our public transport, because we want everyone to be able to use it. And we know how important public transport is, particularly to disabled people. But that's precisely why we're acting. And we know one of the big issues, other than physical accessibility, is about affordability. And that's precisely why we're making these changes that we're announcing today to the disabled person's bus pass, so that someone can use that bus pass to access free bus travel at any times of the day. And of course, that builds on other work that the government is doing to improve affordability for people, reintroducing the £2 bus fare from next January, and of course offering free travel for children during the current month, during the school holidays, so families can get out and about and enjoy the summer.
Okay, Lillian Greenwood, Minister at the Department for Work and Pensions, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's hear a few words from the lexicographer Susie Dent.
What do these words have in common?
Childishness.
Idleness.
Fritters.
Good riddance.
They all lead back to one extraordinary man who wrote a very dangerous book, William Tyndale.
Tyndale was a huge popularizer of phrases, as well as being a master phraseologist himself.
Join me, Susie Dent, as I uncover a remarkable story that transformed our language and learn about the man who sacrificed his life to translate the Bible into everyday English. The deadliest book in England. This afternoon at 4. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
At 7:02, here's Stav with the weather.
Thanks very much, Henry and Anna. Good morning to you. It's turning more unsettled gradually day by day through this week. And eventually, towards the end of the week, Thursday into Friday, it'll feel a lot cooler for all areas, including the southeast. And nights will turn chillier as well. Today, for England and Wales, a rather cloudy start for most. We've got further light showers, even patchy rain affecting parts of southwest England. Northwest England and Wales. Any showers which we've had across the southeast mostly clearing away. And it will turn a little bit drier, I think, as we head through the afternoon, but it will stay mostly cloudy. Still a few showers close to Western England and Western Wales. Best of any sunshine across England and Wales will be across the far south of England later on. Temperatures, Wales, Northern England, 19 to 22 degrees. The Midlands, Southern and Eastern England, still quite warm with 23 to 26 Celsius. Scotland, it's a rather showery day, particularly across the western half of Scotland. Longer spells of rain will affect the northeast and into the northern Isles. But eastern Scotland will see some shelter from the westerly breeze. Best of any brighter or sunnier moments here. Temperatures 15 to 20 degrees. Northern Isle view, cloudy, scattered showers, although it's mostly dry as we head through the day with a lot of cloud around, limited brightness. Temperatures again 15 to 19 Celsius. Westerly winds moderate to fresh across the country, but strong across western Scotland. Tonight we'll see further spells of showers and rain. Tomorrow and for the rest of the week, it's very showery. Some of the showers will be heavy and thundery.
Thank you, Stav. You're listening to Today with Henry Zeffman and Anna Foster.
It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 18th of August. The headlines this morning. A major court case is to get underway with prosecutors from four US states set to accuse Meta of deliberately making Facebook and Instagram addictive for children. Moscow has issued a warning to the UK after confirmation that Ukraine is using British-made drones to strike targets in Russia. And President Trump's envoy, Jared Kushner, has said progress towards disarming Hamas in Gaza could begin within a month.
Also in the next hour of the programme this morning, we have an exclusive report from Germany, now on the front line in a battle against small boats.
Big heavy metal doors. Oh wow, this place is huge. And I'm looking at stacks and stacks of life jackets. They say they took more than 9,000 during this raid.
And FIFA's chief operating officer has been sacked less than 3 weeks after he strongly criticised its president. So is Gianni Infantino tightening his grip on football's governing body? We will discuss. Before that, the BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
A jury trial, which opens in California today, could pose the biggest threat yet to the way Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, operates. There have already been some significant rulings in the US, which found that the company had designed addictive products and endangered children on its platforms. This trial in Oakland is being brought by 30 states, which are claiming numerous violations of federal and state privacy laws for children, and by attorneys general from four states who say that Meta misled the public about the safety of its sites. The tech giant strongly denies the allegations. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
It's being called the largest consumer protection lawsuit in American history and stems from a complaint filed in 2023 by a coalition of U.S. states. They allege Meta incorporated harmful features on Instagram and Facebook to drive young user engagement in a bid to boost profits and then misled the public about it. Meta denies the allegations. It said it stood by its record of creating strong protections for teens and looked forward to making its case in court. A jury will hear testimony for the next 6 weeks, including potentially from Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Jury members will deliver an advisory verdict, but the final outcome will rest with a federal judge who will consider their decision. The trial comes after some high-profile legal losses in similar cases. If Meta loses, the tech giant could face significant fines and be asked to make fundamental changes to the way young people experience social media, including ending like counts and infinite scroll.
Moscow has warned the UK that it will face consequences after confirmation that British-made drones have been used to strike targets in Russia. Kyiv has stepped up its attacks in recent months, using long-range missiles and drones to hit military and energy facilities. Our correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
Ukraine's campaign of strikes hitting oil depots, military sites, logistics hubs and more have been ramping up the economic pressure on President Putin and bringing the war closer to ordinary Russians. Russia's embassy in London said by supplying drones used in those attacks, the UK was deliberately opting for escalation and this action would inevitably carry consequences for which London would have to answer. Russia has made similar threats before over the supply of Challenger tanks and Storm Shadow missiles. The Ministry of Defence said Britain stood shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine and was committed to providing the equipment it needed to defend itself against President Putin's illegal invasion. After Andy Burnham became Prime Minister last month, the first foreign leader he hosted in Downing Street was Ukraine's president. He stressed then that he was with Volodymyr Zelensky 100%.
Russian officials say Ukraine has carried out another major attack overnight, launching more than 600 drones towards the Moscow region. Three people are reported to have been injured. At least two Ukrainians have died in overnight Russian attacks, according to officials in the Zaporizhia region. President Trump's Middle East envoy, Jared Kushner, has suggested that progress towards disarming Hamas and moving forward with a Gaza peace plan could begin within a month. He was speaking to Fox News in Tel Aviv after meeting Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has publicly rejected the latest part of a US plan aimed at bringing peace to Gaza. From Jerusalem, our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports.
There was no breakthrough following Jared Kushner's hours-long talks with Mr. Netanyahu, which came a day after he met Hamas leaders in Egypt. But President Trump's son-in-law sounded upbeat, speaking to Fox News. "We could be seeing progress in as little as 30 days," he said, suggesting some weapons could be removed from Gaza, with some Hamas tunnels later filled in. It was decided that a US general would verify demilitarization, which the Board of Peace has now agreed with the Israeli Prime Minister must take place before Israeli troops withdraw. Hamas has accepted to give up its arms in exchange for a phased Israeli pullout. The US-led Board of Peace has been trying to move forwards on President Trump's stalled Gaza peace plan, with officials privately acknowledging that Mr. Netanyahu is unlikely to make any major concessions before an October general election, particularly with his party trailing in the polls.
BBC Sport has been told that FIFA has sacked the senior executive who publicly criticised its president, Gianni Infantino, for planning to sell stakes in tournaments, including the World Cup. Kevin Lamore, the football governing body's chief operating officer, spoke out less than 3 weeks ago. Mr. Infantino later abandoned the scheme and apologised for errors. Here's our sports editor, Dan Rowan.
Last month, Kevin Lamore publicly condemned Gianni Infantino, the senior executive claiming that he and his FIFA colleagues had been deceived by their boss over the now abandoned FIFA Ford Enterprise project. At the time, the chief operating officer predicted that breaking ranks could result in his departure, adding that he had a duty of loyalty to his employer, but also to certain values. "If that means I lose my job, then so be it," he wrote. "At least I'll sleep well tonight." In a statement, FIFA would only confirm that Mr. Lamore had left, with staff told that the two parties had agreed to part ways after careful consideration. Earlier this month, Gianni Infantino received the backing of senior FIFA executives in a meeting in Morocco, but BBC Sport was told Mr. Lamore was not invited. Mr. Lamore has been approached for comment.
The BBC has learned that a new law making it easier to prosecute small boat smugglers in Germany has been used in raids for the first time. Our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker, has been granted special permission to see the equipment seized by police.
At a secret location in West Germany, we're shown into a cavernous warehouse. There are boxed-up boats, engines and more. I'm looking at stacks and stacks of packaged up life jackets. This is rare access to a hall from spring raids carried out using a new law approved last December. Before that, in Germany, the facilitation of people smuggling wasn't technically illegal to countries like the UK that lie outside of the EU's zone of free movement. Berlin agreed to tighten the law after our BBC investigation exposed how West Germany's used by gangs to store small boats' equipment before it's rushed to northern France. Migrant and law enforcement sources say tougher European policing is helping disrupt supply lines. But the recent emergence of so-called mega dinghies may be a sign of smugglers adapting as they seek to maximise their profits.
The government has announced plans to give around 1 million disabled people in England free bus travel at any time of the day. The current passes place restrictions on travel times unless local councils choose to fund longer hours. More details from our disability reporter, Erica Witherington.
For many disabled people, a free bus pass doesn't always ensure free travel when they actually need it. Currently in England, it's usually valid only from 9:30 in the morning until 11 at night on weekdays. That can leave people having to pay if they need to leave earlier for work, education or medical appointments. Andy Burnham says that will change. As Manchester Mayor, he'd already brought in free 24/7 bus travel for disabled people in the area. Now, £60 million will be spent on extending the scheme across England from April. The Conservatives said that change would involve shuffling money around existing budgets and questioned how it would be funded. But disability charities have welcomed the announcement.
The latest official jobs and wages figures have just been published by the Office for National Statistics. Unemployment was unchanged in the 3 months to June, staying at 4.9%. South East Water is warning some of its customers in Kent that their supplies may not return for another couple of days. Around 8,000 properties have no running water or are experiencing low water pressure. The company has blamed increased demand in the recent hot weather as well as burst pipes and power issues. And Wetherspoons has banned customers from playing music or taking phone calls on loudspeakers in all of its 792 pubs. It said sounds from smartphones and tablet computers had become an increasing problem, with some complaints that the noise was driving people nuts.
Thanks, Charles. It's 9 minutes past seven. Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, has suffered some significant defeats in the courts in recent months over claims its products are designed to be addictive. But a jury trial beginning today in Oakland, California, brought by the top legal officials in California, Colorado, Kentucky and New Jersey, threatens to be the most consequential yet. Not only are the states collectively seeking damages which Meta claim would amount to $1.4 trillion, but perhaps even more significantly, they are demanding major changes to how its products work, including ending like counts and infinite scrolling, as well as implementing a process of parental verification for teenage users. Meta says the state's claims are unsubstantiated and their financial demands are vastly disproportionate. Kelly Stonelake is a former Meta executive who left the company in 2024 and is now an advocate for children's safety online. She launched legal action against Meta last year, saying there was a hostile response to women who raised concerns. Meta deny those allegations. When I spoke to Kelly Stonelake earlier, I asked her why she thought stronger tech regulation was needed.
I saw firsthand what is at the very core of the case kicking off today with opening arguments in Oakland, which is that I saw my fellow product leadership knowingly pursue growth of a product despite there being kids in the product that weren't supposed to be, that were interacting with unknown adults without parental control or consent. And the primary prerogative was to protect Meta and to from potential litigation or legislation, and to ensure that we were able to continue growing without restriction.
From what you know of your former colleagues at Meta, do you think cases like this, and of course this is a significant case, a very significant one, but it is just the latest in a litany of cases of this sort, do you think legal action like this will affect
and change the decision-making of those at the top of Meta?
For those at the top of Meta, I'm not so sure. I think that there is a huge amount of kind of cognitive dissonance and rationalization that has to exist in order to be making decisions like they're making now, despite the evidence that makes very clear that those decisions are harming vulnerable people. But what I do think might really be impacted by legislation and litigation like we're seeing today is the kind of rank and file employees and middle to senior management who have to go and sit around a kind of dinner table with family members who are seeing the news that, you know, okay, in New Mexico, in Los Angeles, and now potentially we're examining the evidence in Oakland, you know, we're seeing evidence that Meta knows they're causing harm and is doing nothing and in fact is profiting significantly from it.
It's really interesting that you talk there about the evidence that might be heard in this case, rather than the potential outcome of this case. Is that what you see as important? What is going to be heard in this court before this jury in Oakland?
The evidence does matter a lot. I think that it is critical. I mean, we saw evidence in Los Angeles, in New Mexico, and it's already been referenced in some of Judge Rogers' orders. But in this case, what I think makes this case that's kicking off today different than the other two cases that we have seen in the United States in the past few months is that the plaintiffs are not just seeking damages, they're also seeking platform changes. And they're asking the judge to invoke changes that the company in question, Meta, would be held to nationwide, not just in their state.
Well, on those platform changes, just quickly, because Meta have done a lot, haven't they, to make their platforms safer. You might say it's not enough, but they've set up teen accounts. They've updated the settings on those accounts to try and make sure teens see content on an app that is age appropriate by default. Why do you believe that stricter controls than that are needed?
Well, there's actually three buckets for this case that we're in right now that the plaintiffs are pursuing. One is COPPA, like I mentioned earlier, knowing that kids under 13, that they're collecting data on kids under 13. The other I just talked about, deception, minimizing risk of harm that they denied or covered it up. But the third one is this unfair product design idea, which is that there's enough evidence to kind of continue to trial that Meta offered safety features that function as reassurance but don't actually make a difference. Because in order to actually be looking after the well-being of folks, including vulnerable folks like kids, they would need to make choices that reduced engagement and time spent on their platform, which they aren't willing to do voluntarily because that's going to cost them.
Just finally, what the various attorneys general from different US states are seeking in this case, as well as changes to the platforms operated by Meta, is a fine of a staggering size, $1.4 trillion. That's almost the total market capitalization of Meta. Some might think that is really an attempt to try and put them out of business. Is that what you want?
Here is what's hilarious about that figure. The plaintiffs did not come up with that number. Meta calculated the number of violations and the potential fines that they could be held to if the plaintiff's legal theory held up. And Meta presented that $1.4 trillion number as a to illustrate how unrealistic and unreasonable this case would be, but the judge proceeded anyway. That said, I don't think the fines are the most important thing here. I think that the structural changes and potential disgorgement and ongoing kind of separation of profits when harmful features are involved is potentially the most impactful outcome of this trial today.
Kelly Stonelake, thank you very much for joining us. And Meta say this: the attorney generals offer no proof anyone in their states was misled, claim benign features like having an additional Instagram account somehow harmed their residents, and attempt to penalise Meta for industry-wide challenges like age verification. We stand by our record of creating strong protections for teens and look forward to making our case in court.
It's 16 minutes past seven now. The Times this morning is reporting that ministers seeking to prevent the early release of the killers of PC Andrew Harper are looking at separating different types of manslaughter cases to exclude some but not others from the scheme. What the paper says is that exempting unlawful act manslaughter prisoners from release while leaving people guilty of other types of manslaughter convictions still eligible to be freed early is being considered. Lord Thomas of Cymdeithas joins us, former Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales from 2013 to 2017. Good morning.
Good morning.
Manslaughter is obviously one of those offences which is very broad. It has different types. When you hear this as a suggestion, is it the kind of thing you think might be workable in practice?
In short, yes. The reason is as follows. Manslaughter is used in people are found guilty of manslaughter in three different circumstances. One, because they've been charged with murder and have a specific defence. Secondly, because they have committed an act which is grossly negligent that has resulted in death. And thirdly, involuntary manslaughter of the kind you've described, where there's been an unlawful act such as a punch. Someone's fallen over, hit his head on the curb and died. That is the unlawful act manslaughter which they're seeking to exempt. So it is quite possible to distinguish the three types of manslaughter.
Is it possible to do that at the stage that prisoners are at now? I'm thinking about the logistics of the scheme and the way that prison staff will go back through. They will look at the sentences. Is that the type of detail that will be readily available to them in practical terms?
Yes, it should be. It may not be that straightforward because normally prisoners are recorded as having committed various offences, normally by reference to a statutory section, and it's easy to tell what the offence is. However, manslaughter is a common law offence, and it may not be the case that the prison records contain details of the offence simply by saying it is, say, an unlawful act manslaughter, or a diminished responsibility, or a loss of control in the case of murder or gross negligence. But it will be easy to tell that, or should be relatively easy to tell that, from the sentencing remarks, which are always transmitted with the prisoner's record.
The reason that the early release scheme is happening, as we know, is to try and reduce the numbers of people being held in prisons because of prison overcrowding. And can we tell how many prisoners this might impact? Because there is the push-pull, as we know, of the need to free up prison space, but also the need to not release people who have committed particularly serious crimes and ones which have really outraged society. So do we know how many people this change, if it happens, might affect?
I'm afraid I don't know. I suspect it is not that many because convictions for manslaughter are not a large number per year. But what the government intends by this is to follow the policy that they've adopted, which is to exclude certain offences. And this would actually enable them to do an exclusion that would at least catch some people who've been convicted of manslaughter simply by reason of the nature of their crime. What you can't do, and what the government's been told it can't do, is to say, well, we release prisoner A who's been convicted of this offence, but we won't release prisoner B. That would be unlawful.
I wonder, Lord Thomas, just as a final thought, as a former Lord Chief Justice, how do you feel about the fact that sentencing is changing in this way? So a sentence as commuted is not necessarily now what people will serve. Do you think that risks undermining the system?
It is much better for a judge to say, this is the amount of the sentence you're going to get. You will serve so much in prison and you will serve so much on license. The problem is that for years it has been obvious that the increase in lengths of sentences is going to result in prison overcrowding, but people have simply shut their eyes to it. And therefore, the public is left in a position. The judge has said one thing, and the government is now effectively doing something different. Parliament's permitted them to do that, so it's perfectly lawful, but it's not a good sentencing policy. We really do need to think, are we prepared to pay more money for more prisons, keep people in prison longer, or do we need a proper review of the overall length of sentences to bring them back to what they were, say, 15, 20, 30 years ago? They've just grown exponentially and caused this problem, which was foreseeable from the outset.
Lord Thomas of Cwmgeir, thanks for joining us this morning.
It's 22 minutes past seven, and the number of vacancies in the jobs market has fallen to its lowest level since 2014, excluding the COVID period. Sean Farrington's back and he has more detail. Hi, Sean. What does this tell
us? Hi, Henry. Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's a small fall in vacancies that has been seen again to 707,000. This is the estimate, first estimate they have in the 3 months to July about the number of jobs that have been advertised out there. So the facts... The last time we saw levels lower than this outside of COVID was towards the end of 2014, is a reminder of sort of where we are historically. Driving this, the Office of National Statistics saying it's smaller businesses not advertising roles as much as they were, citing rising costs. We hear many of them tell us about that on this programme. Rising costs of both workers and general operations as well. But there maybe is some sense from some analysts who are looking at these numbers this morning that there might be a bit of a stabilising in the jobs market. So a small fall in vacancies, but just reminds us of the wider context of where we are after falls for quite some time now.
And what else are in these numbers today?
We get the usual sort of unemployment rate. That's still the same at 4.9%, around where it was last time. And actually, the employment rate, inactivity rate are all around the same. So the ONS talking about there still being a bit of a softening in the labour market. They see the number of employees on payrolls falling a little bit again. Average pay in there as well. So average regular pay, the Bank of England will watch that pretty closely to try and get a sense of are the price pressures that individuals and businesses are feeling, is that starting to feed through into higher pay at all? Average regular pay rose by 3.5% in the period. So that was the 3 months to June. So a little faster than last time round, a little faster than expected as well. It does seem that it's stronger pay rises that are being driven by larger pay awards in the public sector that have kicked in rather than in the private sector quite so much.
Okay, Sean Farrington, thank you very much.
It's 24 minutes past seven. The Royal Parks are warning people not to approach or try to feed deer there. This is after a man in his 60s was attacked by a stag in Richmond Park on Saturday. The male deer had approached the picnic group that he was in. It was looking for food, and it was sadly put down after the incident. And more people, it seems, are trying to feed deer so they can film it for social media. Paul Richards is the park manager. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
There are things that you see online. I'm thinking of places like Nara in Japan, where you have deer who are very accustomed to humans and people routinely feed them and film it. But deer are not the same everywhere, are they?
They're not, and certainly not at Richmond Park and also our sister park, Bushy Park. The deer here are wild. They've been here for centuries. You know, the park that we enjoy is a park that the deer actually have created through their grazing and everything else. So we want to keep them wild. That's the behaviour that, we want to maintain. But we know that obviously visitors like coming to see the deer, and they have for, decades come to Richmond Park or Bushy Park to see the deer. But what we say is just respect the deer. They don't need to be fed. A lot of people are, thinking, well, it's bone dry out there. Everything's sort of brown. But the deer don't need supplementary feeding here at Richmond Park. There's plenty for things for them to eat. They're grazing on bramble. We're already seeing a bit of an early autumn, so like beech mast, and it won't be long before sweet chestnut are starting to fall. So there's plenty of food for them, so visitors don't need to feed them.
In this particular case, it sounds like the man involved, that they were having a picnic, they were there and the stag saw the food and approached. So what should you do in a situation like that if an animal is coming towards you and you don't have too much choice about it?
I think, again, the reason that stag was starting to be quite inquisitive about the picnic is because people have been feeding it. So it's associating people with food. Mm. This is not their natural behaviour. So, you know, just to sort of answer your question, you know, in that sort of situation is just to sort of pick up your belongings and just walk away. You know, just get a safe distance. And, you know, when we talk about safe distancing, we're sort of talking about 50 meters. So that's quite a distance to keep yourself and the animals. But yeah, it's only because people have fed this particular animal that its behavior has changed. Normally, if you come to Richmond Park and have a picnic, you won't be bothered by the deer, and they won't be that inquisitive. As I said, they've got plenty of other things to eat. So yeah, it's just, unfortunately, it's just because people have been feeding this deer, its behavior has changed. And you know, unfortunately, that was the consequences that this poor animal had to then follow.
Well, quite, as we said, you know, and as you're saying there, the animal had to be put down as a result of this, which wouldn't have happened, as you say, had human behaviour not changed the animal's behaviour. So the message is a really clear one. Keep your distance, stay away from them.
It is, you know, it's enjoy the deer, respect the deer, keep a safe distance from the deer. You know, if you want to photograph them, you know, photograph them using the zoom function on your phone or on your camera. And, you know, again, don't feed them. They don't need feeding. You know, some people think they're doing a good deed. In fact, you're not. You're doing quite the opposite. So, you know, just sort of that message of please do not feed the deer. If you see people feeding the deer, please try to correct them. Just make them aware that that is, as I said, it's not the correct thing to do.
It's a very, very clear message that you've given us this morning as well. Paul Richards, the park manager there, thank you.
It's 28 minutes past seven, which means it's time for the sports news with Carthy.
Morning. Thank you very much. Football headlines first. A 98th minute goal from Reuben Colwell meant Cardiff City salvaged a point against Welsh rivals Wrexham at the start of the new championship season. The 1-1 draw last night was the first time the two Welsh sides have met in the league for almost 25 years. FIFA's chief operating officer, Kevin Lamour, has been sacked by the sport's governing body less than 3 weeks after he strongly criticised the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino's aborted plan to sell stakes in competitions, including the World Cup, to private investors. We'll have more on this in around 15 minutes' time. Tennis and Great Britain's Arthur Ferry, playing in his first tournament since reaching the semi-finals at Wimbledon, has been knocked out of the Cincinnati Open in the third round by the fifth seed, Alex de Minaur. Now to horse racing, and the Ebor Festival starts tomorrow and will include the richest race ever staged at York Racecourse. We can speak to William Darby, Chief Executive and Clerk of the course. Morning, William.
Good morning, Carthy.
It's the last big festival of the summer in terms of flat racing, and the richest race, as I mentioned, the £500,000 Judmont International. You always have horses from around the world at the Ebor Festival, but does that prize money change the international status at all of the meeting?
Well, I think it does, Carthy. It enables us to attract some of the best horses from around the world to come and race it at our race course at close to the city centre in York. So we've got the joint highest rated horse and defending champion Ombudsman looking to take on young pretenders like Constitution River from Aidan O'Brien's powerful Ballydoyle Yard. So we've really got some of the best collection of horses racing in front of us this week. Horses from Japan, America and Australia are all trying to take on the best of Europe.
Yeah, well, it definitely sounds like it's a big global racing event. We were talking about York City returning to the English Football League this season after a decade away at the weekend on this programme. It's obviously the place to be. What's the economic impact of the Ebor Festival on the area?
Yeah, it's a big economic impact in terms of people coming to the city. As I say, we're close to the city centre, so people make a real break of it, enjoy what York has to offer as a city. It's about £60 million per annum into the city centre we generate as part of a £200 million per annum economy in Yorkshire. There's lots of training yards here, lots of jockeys based in the region, and we have 9 fantastic racecourses in Yorkshire. So it's a real sort of cradle of the thoroughbred worldwide, and we're looking forward to the eyes of that racing world, as you say, focusing on our city and our racecourse this week.
And we do know that it's obviously been very hot over the summer. It's cooling down now for your festival. But what have been the challenges for horses and I suppose also for jockeys and crowds over the last few weeks?
Yes, goodness, hasn't it been a hot and dry summer? Farmers, trainers, race courses, golf courses across the country We've got a fantastic grounds team at York. We spend a lot of time and effort and resource on our racing surface. We have two boreholes that go 100 metres under the racing surface at York. The apocryphal story is that the rain that fell in the Roman times is what we're putting on the track each night. And we have a green, beautiful ribbon of grass amongst a sort of pretty parched and brown centre of the course, the Naysmar, the common land in York. So it's a perfect stage for the horses coming this week. We race Wednesday to Saturday, and it's as you say, the last big flagship of the summer after Royal Ascot, Glorious Goodwood, and ourselves sort of staging those big meetings during the British summer.
I'm not sure what green grass looks like anymore. Thank you very much, William Darby. We will have racing tips back on the Today programme tomorrow for the Ebor Festival. Just a little bit of golf news to finish. LIV Golf has cancelled next week's team championships in Michigan, saying it needs to focus on building its next chapter. This week's event in Indianapolis will now be the last LIV tournament of the season.
Thank you, Cathy. Now let's look ahead to this afternoon.
Comedy drama on BBC Radio 4.
I've always been a huge fan of Yes Minister.
It's 1984 and Margaret Thatcher is about to perform a comedy sketch with the reluctant cast of her favourite show.
Our show is being hijacked for political gain.
She may be the Iron Lady, but when it comes to comedy, she has a decidedly tin ear.
No Prime Minister, starring Miles Jupp.
All feels a little bit too political for my liking.
And Fenella Woolgar.
I feel sure I can achieve the desired comedic effect.
No, Prime Minister.
This afternoon at 2:15. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
Russia has warned Britain will pay a higher price for backing Ukraine after UK-made drones were used in strikes inside Russian territory. After the news, we'll speak to the former Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Andrei Fedorov.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Henry Zeffman and Anna Foster. And at 27 minutes to 8, Charles Carroll has a summary of the news.
A major jury trial gets underway in California today in which 30 US states will accuse Meta of deliberately designing some of its platforms to be addictive to young users. If the technology giant, which owns Facebook and Instagram, loses, it may have to pay upwards of $1 trillion in damages. Meta strongly denies the allegations and says that it stands by its record of creating strong protection for teens. Moscow has threatened the UK with consequences after it was confirmed that Ukraine had used British-made drones to strike targets inside Russia. The Russian embassy in London accused Britain of deliberately escalating the war in Ukraine. The Ministry of Defence says it remains committed to supplying Ukraine with the equipment it needs to defend itself. In the last half hour, the latest official jobs and wages figures have been published by the Office for National Statistics. Unemployment was unchanged in the 3 months to June, staying at 4.9%. President Trump's Middle East envoy, Jared Kushner, has suggested that progress towards disarming Hamas and moving forward with a Gaza peace deal could begin within a month. He was speaking to Fox News in Tel Aviv after meeting Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has publicly rejected the latest part of a US plan aimed at bringing peace to Gaza. The meeting came a day after Mr. Kushner held talks with Hamas leaders in Egypt. Southeast Water says that 400 properties in some areas of Kent still have no water or are experiencing low water pressure this morning. Supplies have been restored to the 7,400 properties which were experiencing the same problems yesterday. The company has blamed increased demand in the recent hot weather, as well as burst pipes and power issues. And Wetherspoons has banned customers from playing music or taking phone calls on loudspeakers in all 792 of its pubs. It said sounds from smartphones and tablet computers had become an increasing problem, with some complaints that the noise was driving people nuts.
Thank you, Charles. Now, Russia says it downed 180 of 620 drones that were fired towards it by Ukraine overnight. Another of the online retailer Wildberries warehouses has been hit as well, this one near Moscow. It is another example of Ukraine's changing tactics, favouring targets deep inside Russia to have an impact on people who are living there. Ukraine's Deputy Chief of Military Intelligence, Vadim Skibitsky, has told the BBC's Dan Johnson about their ambition inside Russian territory.
We should destroy and disrupt, first of all, production, weaponry. And that is why one of the main targets, main object for us is defense industry. And, of course, next one, logistics system, including, in some case, Wildberries, for example. Why? Because It's one of the elements of the logistic system of Russian Federation to wage the war, including, for example, through Wildberries, some military equipment, military components, and another elements that Russian Federation uses for war.
Well, I've been talking to Andrei Fedorov, former deputy foreign minister of Russia and an advisor to the current administration. I asked him how seriously we should take new threats from the Russian embassy here in the UK of consequences due to Kyiv's use of British-made drones in some of those attacks.
Such kind of threats have been done even before on the higher level than our embassy in London, but it's a very sensitive issue. There are a lot of people also at the top in Moscow who are saying that all the enterprises which are linked with Ukraine could be struck by Russia because they are legal targets. But the problem is, of course, is that the UK, as well as other countries, are members of NATO. The question is that in Moscow, there are also mixed feelings about this. Even some experts are saying that don't worry if Russia will, for example, strike UK, nothing will change, NATO will not answer. And the others are saying, so it's quite dangerous because it can start a new tension, which is much more serious than Ukrainian war.
Just listening to you speak there, Mr. Fedorov, are you saying that the embassy in London is speaking on behalf of Moscow here? Or is it going slightly off-piste when it talks about London's actions inevitably having consequences for which it will have to answer? Can you really envisage a scenario in which Moscow would attack the UK, would strike the UK with missiles?
First of all, any embassy in any country speaking on behalf of their government, and Moscow, of course, giving some directives to the embassy, including embassy in UK, in United Kingdom. Concerning the possibility, nothing can be excluded from my personal point of view, because the risk of confrontation is now growing. Escalation in war in Ukraine will increase quite soon again. We have many problems linked to the situation in the Baltic Sea and the situation with the possible seas of tankers which are carrying Russian oils, etc., etc., maybe even close to UK shores. So that's why nothing could be excluded.
That would surely be a reckless choice by Vladimir Putin to attack a country like the UK, which would provoke a response from NATO. And so far during this war, he has avoided starting a war with NATO. Why would he do that now?
I said to you, because there are a lot of people in the expert community, in the military community, who are saying that don't worry, that Russia can strike UK, and NATO will do nothing. Trump will not allow NATO to answer. This is the fact which is existing now.
Is that something you believe, Mr. Fedorov, that NATO would not intervene if the UK was attacked by Russia? Do you believe that to be true?
Taking into consideration current instability within NATO, current problems within NATO, it's quite possible that NATO will do nothing. Will make a statement or will use Article 4 or etc., but not Article 5. This is linked not to NATO as it is. It's linked, first of all, to Donald Trump, who is still the keeper of the keys in NATO.
But even if the US chose not to get involved, and that would have consequences for the future of NATO, would Vladimir Putin not fear UK retaliation at the very least?
No, of course it's possible, because UK is a nuclear power. The question is that such kind of retaliation is a very sensitive issue for UK government, because everyone should calculate consequences.
The thing I don't quite understand from our conversation so far, Mr. Fedorov, is when, up until this point, President Putin has avoided, on many occasions where he could have provoked a war with NATO, he's avoided that. I'm trying to understand what might have changed now that he would consider such a reckless act, and one at which would be incredibly dangerous to Russia, which is itself depleted from years of war with Ukraine.
Yeah, of course. there are some changes. And changes are very simple. It's a serious increase of attacks on Russia, also with the use of the drones produced in UK. Just take an example of today's morning when Moscow, territory of Moscow and Moscow region was attacked with about 600 drones. And this really raised concerns in Kremlin that such kind of development is very, very dangerous for Russia, for Russian economy, for Russian people. So that's why it's very easy sometimes in Moscow to interpret such kind of strikes and such kind of things that UK is part of the war and Russia has the full right to strike the country which is supporting Ukraine. Situation is now is very dangerous because the tension in conflict with Ukraine is really increasing, and the coming couple of months we'll face this tension and we'll face this escalation, which can bring us to a totally different situation like never before.
Andrei Fedorov, former Deputy Foreign Minister of Russia, thank you.
Thank you.
It's 18 minutes to 8.
The BBC's gained rare access to a secret German storage site packed with seized boats, engines, life jackets. This is after police used tough new anti-smuggling powers for the first time. You can hear that report before 8 this morning. But it's time now for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is the Reverend Dr. Michael Spence, President and Provost of University College London. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I've spent about half my life in England and half in Australia, so watching the television news over the past few weeks has been somewhat confusing. I think of England as a place where nature is more or less under control, a green and pleasant land, mild in climate with a landscape shaped by generations of human hands. Raging wildfires, the terrifying unpredictability of nature out of control, railway engineering disrupted by scorching heat, that seems part of a different place. That reminds me of my childhood driving through areas destroyed by bushfire, areas in which, as the poet Judith Wright put it, charred death upon the rock leans his charred bone and stares at death from sockets black with flame. Reflecting on nature under control and out of control, I wonder if this notion of control isn't exactly where the problem lies. At least since the Industrial Revolution, we've tended to see the natural world as brute matter for moulding to our will, as so much stuff to be exploited, to be consumed. That approach has brought progress, but also the damage to our planet and the climate change from which we now suffer. Our thirst for control has led us to a place where many young people, faced with an ecological crisis, feel more out of control than ever before. The bewitching vision of the writer of the Book of Genesis is so very different. In the garden story, the relationship between the human and the natural world is not one of control, but of authority, of rule with a delegated responsibility for the natural world. Nature in this tradition is both an essentially good gift and one damaged by rebellion against its giver, the Creator. It's therefore to be treasured, but not to be worshipped nor even simply affirmed. So we're right to be grateful for fire when it warms and to be repelled by it when it kills. The human responsibility is not to control nature, but to tend it as one tends a garden, to work with it when we can and to work for its healing when we can't. In this vein, for example, science has recently affirmed the wisdom of ancient Australian Aboriginal practices of fire management. Practices that by contained burning, by working with rather than against country, limit the occurrence of more devastating fire. Had we listened more carefully to the Genesis story over the last 250 years, and less to the logic of consumption and control, we might now be in a better place ecologically. Reflecting on the story at this point may just give our planet a chance.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Michael Spence, President and Provost of University College London. It is 7:45.
FIFA has sacked its chief operating officer, Kevin Lamore, less than 3 weeks after he strongly criticised its president, Gianni Infantino's plan to sell stakes in competitions to private investors. That plan was then shelved hours after Mr. Lamore spoke out. So what does this mean for Gianni Infantino's battle to save his job?
To analyse that, we're joined by David Bernstein, who is, of course, the former chairman of the Football Association and has been one of the most prominent English voices calling for reform of FIFA. Good morning, Mr. Bernstein.
Good morning.
Well, Kevin Lamore, as you'll know, joined FIFA not even quite 2 years ago, having been Deputy General Secretary at UEFA, the European Football Confederation. And it's UEFA which has been leading the charge against Gianni Infantino. What do you read into this decision to sack him?
Well, I think it's probably inevitable. You can't have a chairman and chief executive who sort of, where there is a clear loss of confidence and for the situation to continue. So I'm not really surprised at that. But I don't think in a way it's particularly significant because the challenge to Infantino isn't going to come from within FIFA. It has to come from outside and particularly from UEFA, who have maintained a strong position so far. But we need to see now whether they will really walk the walk and face Infantino down. Because if they don't, I think he will continue in position for the moment.
Well, what does walk the walk mean? Because, of course, there is Gianni Infantino's re-election effort coming up next year. But UEFA are still talking about a boycott of FIFA competitions. Of course, we've just had the Men's World Cup, but it's the FIFA Women's Under-20s World Cup kicking off in Poland on September the 5th, less than a month away. Six European countries are due to take part in that, including England. Should England be taking part in that?
No, I don't think they should. Not on our own, but as part of a UEFA ban, I think UEFA have to go through with their threat not to participate. I'd be very sorry for the, you know, the competitors and so on, but this is a very tough situation, and Infantino has to be eyeballed here. And if UEFA and the other confederations go sort of soft now, then you can see the opposition sort of just drifting away, and you know, people get bored about these issues. It'll lose its momentum, and you can see him staying in place until next year.
Well, speaking of people getting bored of these issues, when you were FA chairman, you, the English FA, abstained from the 2011 FIFA presidential election in which Sepp Blatter was re-elected for his third term. And by the end, it was a pretty lonely mission for you and for the FA, wasn't it? Does it feel different to you this time? Sorry, go on.
Sorry, it was. I spoke out at the FIFA Congress in front of 2,000 delegates against Blatter's being we put a position unopposed because it became a coronation in his case. So, you know, I am one for actually following up very aggressive words with action. Otherwise, it's all pretty meaningless. But we'll have to see. If UEFA don't stay tough and don't stay firm, and the main force they've got is boycotting FIFA events. I have to say also that sponsors have a role to play, because if sponsors start to withdraw their support, that will put huge pressure onto FIFA. But it won't come internally. I think Infantino will have his own people lined up behind him.
You talked about that moment in 2011 when you looked out on the sea of faces at FIFA's Congress who were not with you and were not with the FA. Is this a more serious moment for football than that? How high are the stakes here?
I think this is very, very serious. I mean, Infantino's attempt to sell off part of FIFA at what appears to be an undervalue, done secretly, undemocratically, and so on, really was a dreadful move. And there was a complete schism in football now. And if this is allowed to continue, things will only get worse. I think things will probably die down a bit if it's not brought to a head. But nevertheless, it's a very unhealthy situation. And frankly, I think Infantino has shown himself not to be a fit and proper person to chair FIFA. So my view is, it's UEFA who've got the power. You can't really have worthwhile FIFA competitions without the European nations involved. And England, as a major influence, have to sort of stand very firm. And I hope give UEFA sort of, you know, additional iron in their spine.
OK, David Bernstein, former chairman of the FA, will be watching closely to see what happens.
It is 10 to 8 now.
Dinghies, engines, pumps and life jackets. Just some of the equipment seized from smuggling gangs in a joint operation in Germany by German authorities, working with British and French officials. The raids followed a new law coming into force in Germany in January, specifically to enable this sort of enforcement activity. Before that, it wasn't technically illegal in the country to facilitate people smuggling to countries outside of the EU's free movement zone, including, of course, the UK. Well, our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker, sent this report.
We're on the road to West Germany. I can't say exactly where. The police have asked us to keep the location a secret. But we're going to get a rare glimpse into their work in efforts to crack down on small boat crossings to the UK. Because remember, gangs use West Germany as a hub for storing small boats' equipment before it's then rushed to the coast of northern France. Big heavy metal doors. And then we go, oh wow, this place is huge. I'm in a big brick-walled warehouse and I'm looking at stacks and stacks of packaged up life jackets. There's loads of them. They say they took more than 9,000 during this raid. This equipment was seized during spring raids that used a new law in Germany for the first time, and we're seeing the results. Listening to my footsteps, you can get maybe an idea of how big this warehouse is. And I've come over to more cardboard boxes. And inside those are dinghies, deflated dinghies.
Also on the programme, a BBC investigation finds evidence that people traffickers are storing small boats in Germany before migrants use them to try and cross the
channel. 2 years ago, our BBC investigation exposed West Germany's role as a staging post in the small boats supply chain. Our reporter went undercover.
They tell me the equipment comes from Turkey. They have about 10 warehouses around Essen.
Germany then agreed to change the law, specifically criminalising the facilitation of people smuggling to the UK, because certain anti-smuggling laws had stopped applying to Britain after Brexit.
To remedy this, the United Kingdom was added again to the list of countries which the code applies to.
Bernard Schmeisel is a specialist in UK-German law.
So now it is the same situation as it was before Brexit, but the UK is explicitly mentioned.
Do you think it's really a priority for German police to prosecute these kinds of cases?
They all are understaffed and they, to be honest, may focus on what they see more purely domestic matters. But technically, they have to go after this. So if they're being notified about such a suspicious activity, they will have to investigate and then they will eventually have to punish those people.
One law change agreed here in Berlin isn't going to be a silver bullet, but migrant and enforcement sources say tougher policing in Europe is helping to disrupt supply chains, possibly a factor driving some smugglers to put more people onto bigger boats. Because these gangs don't just abandon their money-making schemes, rather they evade and they adapt.
Fascinating. Well, to put that into context, we're joined by Dr. Meekna Quabus from the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Quabus. Just give us some context. How much of the equipment used by these smuggling gangs is sourced through Germany? Do we know?
We can't know for sure. We do know that the traditional supply chain of smugglers does go through Germany. So most of the equipment is produced in China. It has historically gotten into Europe mostly through Turkey before making its way towards Germany through the Balkans, particularly through Bulgaria.
And I was really interested in Jessica Parker's report there that this was a raid in Germany by German authorities, but also working with British officials and French officials. And that's been at the heart of the Labour government's response to small boat crossings over the past 2 and a bit years is increased international cooperation. Is that yielding results?
I think We've seen numbers move in the right direction over the last year or so. If we look at the arrivals in 2026 so far, numbers are down by around 40%. As you say, working more with European partners, enforcement, whether that's on French beaches, whether that's in terms of trying to disrupt supply chains, that's a big part of the government's plans. Now, all of this might be playing a role in the decline that we can't be sure exactly why we've seen numbers go down.
Now, there's been some pretty well commented upon images in recent weeks of so-called mega dinghies making the crossing across the channel. Bigger dinghies than usual with far more people than usual on them. Is that partly a response to the more typical dinghies having been seized in operations like this?
Most likely. So what we've seen since 2018, when small boats starting arriving in bigger numbers, is that smugglers have kept packing more people onto the same boat. The average number of people per boat back in 2018 was 7. That's gone steadily up over the years to an average of around 65. In the last 12 months, it's simply been more efficient and more profitable for gangs to pack more people onto the same boat. And I think the arrivals of these so-called mega dinghies is just an acceleration of this existing trend, most likely due to these supply chain pressures.
So essentially what that shows is that the smuggling gangs, even if the numbers are falling and the government is pleased with that, are highly adaptable.
Exactly. And that's the challenge at the heart of unauthorized migration for the UK as well as for other countries. It's essentially a sort of cat and mouse dynamic between smugglers and the government, where each of the two sides try to find the best way around the other's measures. And I think what we're seeing with the mega dinghies, what we're seeing also in terms of smugglers trying to leave from further down south in France or from Belgium, essentially trying to evade the police patrolling the beaches. We're seeing this constant adaptation across all areas, and it's likely to continue in the future.
Okay, Dr. Meekner Quabus from the University of Oxford, thanks for joining us.
It is just a couple of minutes to 8 o'clock now. Tonight we'll be following up on some of the themes from the 2024 Reith Lectures.
I'm Gwen Adshead. I'm a psychiatrist working with violent offenders.
No kid is seeking anything when he joins a gang. He's always fleeing something.
I'm finding out how former gang members in the US are rebuilding their lives.
I never thought of myself being good, but you come here, you realize that it's been there all along.
And I ask what can be learned from their success here in the UK.
When you got prisons that were 99.9% full, nothing good really happens.
Saving Young Men from Murder, the homeboy story, this evening at 8. On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now, 2 minutes to 8, here's the weather forecast with Staff.
Thanks very much, Henry and Anna. Good morning to you. It's turning cooler now across northern areas. This cooler theme will push southwards from Wednesday onwards, and with low pressure around, it's going to be breezier. There'll be sunshine showers. Some of these showers will be heavy and thundery, even a risk of some localised flooding in places as they continue to push southwards. By the time we reach Friday, it will be cooler across all areas, both by day and nights will be chilly as well. Today, England and Wales, it's a cloudy start for most. A few light showers around southwest England. Those showers clearing from the southeast of England, but we'll continue to see northwest England, western Wales, a couple of showers peppering coastal areas there for the next few hours. Most places will be cloudy. The best of any sunshine will be reserved for southern England later. Temperatures range from 19 to 25 or 26 degrees again across the southeast. It's still quite warm in the south. Scotland, Northern Ireland, rather cloudy day for you. Most of the showers will be across western Scotland. Best of any brightness will be eastern Scotland. Temperature-wise, we're looking at 15 to 20 degrees.
Thank you, Stav. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Henry Zeffman and Anna Foster.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 18th of August. The headlines this morning. A landmark trial begins in California today, which will see the tech giant Meta, owner of Facebook and Instagram, accused by 30 US states of fueling a mental health crisis in a generation of children. Critics say this is big tech's big tobacco moment.
It's a defective product, essentially. And so that's what these states are trying to prove through a variety of ways, by the way. But it's the first time, I think, they have these tech companies on the run.
Meta strongly disagrees. A court will decide. We'll hear both views in the next hour. Moscow has issued a warning to the UK after confirmation that Ukraine is using British-made drones to strike targets in Russia. The number of job vacancies has dipped slightly, falling to its lowest level in more than 5 years.
And coming up in the next hour of the programme, there's been rain at last for large parts of the country that haven't seen it for weeks. So what does it mean for drought-hit farmers?
Last night we had the first rain. We recorded 8 mil, which is the Goldilocks effect of rain overnight, because it's not too much and it's not too little.
And we'll speak to the 88-year-old who's changing the game in the world of weightlifting. The BBC News is read by Charles Carroll.
A jury trial, which opens in California today, could pose the biggest threat yet to the way Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, operates. There have already been some significant rulings in the US, which found that the company had designed addictive products and endangered children on its platforms. This trial in Oakland is being brought by 30 states, which are claiming numerous violations of federal and state privacy laws for children, and by attorneys general from 4 states who say Meta misled the public about the safety of its sites. The tech giant strongly denies the allegations. Our North America technology correspondent Lily Jamali reports.
It's being called the largest consumer protection lawsuit in American history and stems from a complaint filed in 2023 by a coalition of U.S. states. They allege Meta incorporated harmful features on Instagram and Facebook to drive young user engagement in a bid to boost profits and then misled the public about it. Meta denies the allegations. It said it stood by its record of creating strong protections for teens and looked forward to making its case in court. A jury will hear testimony for the next 6 weeks, including potentially from Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Jury members will deliver an advisory verdict, but the final outcome will rest with a federal judge who will consider their decision. The trial comes after some high-profile legal losses in similar cases. If Meta loses, the tech giant could face significant fines and be asked to make fundamental changes to the way young people experience social media, including ending like counts and infinite scroll.
Kelly Stonelake is a former Meta executive who left in 2024 and is now an advocate for children's online safety. She told us that while she doesn't think those at the top of the company are very much bothered by litigation, she does believe other workers at Meta will start to be affected by it.
The kind of rank and file employees and middle and senior management who have to go and sit around a kind of dinner table with family members who are seeing the news that, you know, okay, in New Mexico, in Los Angeles, and now potentially we're examining the evidence in Oakland, you know, we're seeing evidence that Meta knows they're causing harm and is doing nothing, and in fact is profiting significantly from it.
Moscow has threatened the UK with consequences after it was confirmed that Ukraine used British-made drones to strike targets inside Russia. The Russian embassy in London said Britain was deliberately opting for an escalation of the Ukraine crisis, and the deeper the UK's involvement in the conflict, the higher the price it would pay. Russia has made similar threats before over the supply of Challenger tanks and Storm Shadow missiles. The Ministry of Defence said it was committed to providing the equipment Ukraine needed to defend itself. Andrei Fedorov, who's an advisor to the Kremlin, told us nothing was off the table when it came to ways in which Moscow could retaliate.
It's very easy sometimes in Moscow to interpret such kind of strikes and such kind of things that UK is part of the war and Russia has the full right to strike the country which is supporting Ukraine.
A Russian missile attack is reported to have killed 10 people in a village in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region. The regional governor told Reuters that the strike on the village of Pechenye had injured a further 8 people. The unemployment rate remained at 4.9% between April and June, according to the latest figures from the Office for National Statistics. The number of job vacancies dipped slightly to its lowest level in more than 5 years. Here's our Deputy Economics Editor, Dashini David.
At a challenging time for some job seekers, these numbers suggest the labour market remains flat. While reliability of the unemployment figures has been affected by data collection issues, a similar picture is painted elsewhere, with a further small fall in the number of vacancies and the number of employees on payrolls. The ONS says smaller firms in particular may be hesitant about hiring due to higher labour and other costs. And analysts warn of further risks if the war in the Middle East drags on. Average wage growth picked up a touch to 3.5% in early summer, continuing to outpace inflation, although those in the private sector typically saw smaller pay rises, risking a squeeze on households.
The government's advisor on the economics of AI has said fairly dramatic action will be required to help retrain some workers to access new jobs. Simon Johnson told the BBC that white-collar clerical workers could struggle to access new opportunities, which will replace jobs lost to AI automation. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
Simon Johnson was appointed as the chair of the government's AI Economics Institute in June, an effort to track the impact of the new technology on jobs and the public finances. He told BBC Newsnight that while there was no conclusive data yet, CEOs were now saying they needed fewer workers in major companies, in large part because of new AI tools. Mr. Johnson said careful planning could reduce the impact.
We have time, if we act now, to prepare and to build a stronger, more resilient economy with more good jobs that incorporates AI and that's empowered by AI. The key thing is to avoid getting run over by AI.
The Nobel Prize winner said the UK could find a balance between an unregulated US aggressively pursuing AI without considering the impact on jobs and an overregulated EU. Britain, he said, could benefit from many new opportunities, especially in science.
President Trump's Middle East envoy, Jared Kushner, has expressed hopes of progress after holding talks on Gaza with Israeli and Hamas leaders, but no major breakthrough appears to have been made. After talks with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Mr. Kushner said that there should now be progress on Hamas disarmament in about a month. But Israeli officials say the two men agreed to conditions which Hamas has so far rejected, that there must be no reconstruction in Gaza without the group's complete disarmament, and that Israel could continue carrying out targeted killings. Former workers at the UK's newest prison have told the BBC of a chaotic atmosphere, saying it was understaffed and they received inadequate training. One said they were told it cost too much to properly teach employees of HMP Millsike near York how to defend themselves. The jail's interim director is said to have acknowledged that recruitment has been difficult. Louise Fuster reports.
When it opened in March 2025, Millsike was described by the government as setting the standard for jails of the future. But the BBC spoke to seven former workers, with several saying they felt unsafe working there. A specialist team which deals with the most serious incidents was called to Millsike seven times in its first 9 months. Of the four other privately run Category C prisons in England the BBC received data for, Millsike had higher call-out numbers for this team than all but one, despite having fewer prisoners. Mighty, the firm that runs Millsike, said call-outs were in line with expectations for a Cat C jail. It said safety was its highest priority and was operating in line with plans agreed with the government for training, staffing and recruitment. The government said it actively managed all prison contracts and took action when standards fell short.
The parents of at least 30 children have told the BBC they suspect they were given the wrong sperm or egg donations during IVF treatments in northern Cyprus. Fertility clinics in the Turkish-occupied territory are popular with British people who need medical help to have a baby, but are loosely regulated. The BBC's latest investigation centres on one IVF clinic, as Anna Collinson reports.
The parents of seven children told us in March that they feared their chosen donor sperm or eggs weren't used during their IVF treatments. That number has now risen to 30 children. 11 have completed DNA tests. Charities say it's a fundamental right for donor-conceived people to know where they come from, and the affected families are concerned that they don't know their children's full medical history or whether they have unknown biological siblings. One mother, who recently learned that she was deceived about who her sperm donor was, told us the number of families potentially affected is absolutely scandalous. Many of these cases are linked to Doge IVF Centre. The owner hasn't responded to our questions, neither has the Northern Cypriot government, which launched an investigation when first alerted to the issue.
South East Water says that 400 properties in some areas of Kent still have no water or are experiencing low water pressure this morning. Supplies have been restored to 7,400 properties which were experiencing the same problems yesterday. The company has blamed increased demand in the recent hot weather, as well as burst pipes and power issues.
Thank you, Charles. It's 8:10. This could be the moment the social media industry changes for good. A lawsuit brought by 30 US states against the tech giant Meta opens in part in a US court today, with four of them represented. They say the company deliberately designed its apps like Facebook and Instagram to get children addicted to its services, and that is causing irreparable damage to their mental health as well as breaking privacy laws. Meta says the case simply doesn't show real-world evidence of that harm, and that the financial damages being sought are wildly unreasonable. That number, it's claimed, is $1.4 trillion, which is close to the company's market cap. Those bringing the suit, though, say it's not ultimately about money. They want an end to some of the most compelling features described as dopamine-manipulating recommendation algorithms, auto-playing videos, and image filters that drastically change people's appearance. Well, in a moment, we'll hear from a former senior economic advisor to President Trump who agrees with Meta that the lawsuit is a financial land grab. But first, Kara Swisher, tech journalist and podcaster, told me she thinks it is the right and necessary moment to change the industry to better protect young people.
Well, a lot of people feel it's the cigarette moment, right? A lot of people for years have thought that Meta was like the cigarette companies. But right now, a lot of these cases are hinging on things like nuisance, breaking safety laws, and essentially product liability, which is another approach. Some of them are around copyright also, which are existing laws in the United States that are pretty strong compared to most of the ways we have dealt with tech companies.
When we talk about tech companies and the way that mm-hmm. they've developed their products, there are those mm-hmm. that say they were always developed to create harm, and those who say that was a byproduct of what they were trying to make. Where do you stand on that debate?
Well, I'm probably the second, more than the third. It's not, you know, cigarette companies, you know, people enjoyed smoking. At the same time, they were fully aware of the damage that their product would cause. And so the question is, even if they meant niceness, the way they've designed it and the way they've created addictive features or the way it affects kids, and especially it's focused a lot on kids in this country, it's a defective product essentially, and they now know it, and they've known it for a while. And so that's what these states are trying to prove through a variety of ways, by the way. But it's the first time I think they have these tech companies on the run.
How much evidence is there? Medical evidence, different things.
Lots.
But actually, yeah, well, so this is the question. Tell me what there is to actually back up the argument that's being made that this is damaging to children's mental health. Because so often it's anecdotal. It's what people see in their own children, their own family.
No.
So tell me what's there, what's beneath it.
No, there's been study after studies. There's so many studies, including studies that they do internally at Facebook. And so there's been a lot of whistleblowers. If you remember Frances Haugen, there's many others. And then Discovery, what are we going to find that they know their products do? How do they design them? Are they designed to be addictive on purpose when they say they aren't? There's all manner of things that'll be a problem in a trial because of Discovery, and they're going to have to be truthful, especially since there's email trails. One of the great things about technology is you can't hide a lot of stuff. Neither could cigarette companies, by the way, many years ago. And so there's been a lot of studies about the sort of the deleterious effects on kids for lots of reasons. It isn't anecdotal. It's very clear. In many cases. Now, that's what the trial's for, is to figure out what they knew, when they knew it, what the damage was, what they thought the damage was. And that's where we're going to go from here, which is going to be revelatory to American citizens, I think.
And if the clarity is there, as you say, why are the tech companies digging in? Why haven't they looked at their house and said, we need to put this in order and change the way we do things?
Why didn't the cigarette companies? Why did they dig in? Because it's a lot of money. You know, at some point, there were hundreds and hundreds of cigarette cases before the big ones, right? And that's what's happening here, is there was lots of little ones, a lot of people complaining like me, like, hey, this is problematically designed, or this is addictive, or this is that. And I think, you know, it's easier to pay things off or get small fines from the government. And we have a government here, not just this one, but this one too, which is just completely gives carte blanche to the tech companies. And there's no regulatory scheme whatsoever, as there is on lots of other companies. You're going to have a real problem here eventually when they suck up all the profits, ruin all the businesses, and hurt all the children. And so that's really, you know, we'll see if it gets proven in court. But of course, they're going to try to say, no, they didn't do this. No, they didn't mean it is not a really good defense either, by the way.
So if there isn't the political will for change, is there the legal will for change?
Yes, and this is the way it was always going to be because our politicians have completely, and both Democratic and Republican politicians have abrogated their responsibility. Now, there's a lot of movements around the world and they're all of different kinds. So interesting, in this country, it's being manifested through data centers, which these companies also need. And there's been a lot of pushback on those. And it's the same, they're proxies for the anger over all manner of things with tech companies who have never really paid the price for their inventions. Now, the only issue is, you could argue cigarettes just aren't good for people. And there's a lot of stuff about social media and technology that is good. And so that's where it's going to be a problematic situation. Some of it is good, some of it is bad. What should they have to pay for? And what are they responsible for?
And what about those politicians who say parental responsibility? That's a big part of this. You can't lay everything at the door of the companies.
I guess, is it a parent's responsibility to limit alcohol? I suppose, but there's also rules in place around teens. I mean, lots of kids drink and are sneak drinking, but it doesn't mean our society can't say, as a society, we don't agree with this, or you shouldn't drive until you're a certain age, or you shouldn't smoke until you're a certain age, or you can't go in the military until a certain age. We do it everywhere else. And so the fact that we can't do it here is just canard by these companies. Of course we can.
What impact is this likely to have on companies like Meta? If they lose a court case like this one, will they change the way that they do business?
Nobody goes out of business. They just have to, they have to have rules like the rest of us. You know, the deli on my corner has more rules on it than Facebook does. I don't think that's a great idea. They also pay more taxes, by the way. I mean, in relative terms. But, you know, no, they'll be fine. They'll just have to run their business a different way.
That's Kara Swisher, tech journalist and podcaster. Well, let me tell you what Meta says. In quite a long statement, actually, from Meta spokesperson. Among it, it says that the attorney generals, the state attorney generals here, are not sticking to the facts or the law and have instead decided to chase an outlandish payout. The company also says that it stands by its record of creating strong protections for teens, that it looks forward to making its case in court. Well, Stephen Moore is somebody else that I've been talking to about this. He's a former senior economic advisor to President Donald Trump, who thinks that the internet should be a space for free growth. And he told me that he thinks Meta's being targeted because it's got deep pockets.
This is the trial lawyers seeing a big new payday like they did when they sued tobacco companies 25 or 30 years ago. So this has become a political football here in the United States, where many of the state attorney generals and private parties are going after Meta for harm that might have been caused by material that is on the internet. This is, in my opinion, just a cash payday for trial lawyers and others who feel like they can go after Meta and technology companies because they have deep pockets. But we've always believed that the internet should be regulation-free and tax-free. It's one of the reasons the U.S. has come to dominate the internet age, because we kept the government away from the internet and made parents responsible for what their kids were watching and seeing, not the companies that make the internet possible.
Why do you think this is about a payout rather than public protection? Because you talked about the tobacco industry, and that was very much about the protection of health, particularly of younger people. So why do you see this as different to that? It sounds like it doesn't sound like you think it's well motivated.
I think the people who are going to make all the money off this are the trial lawyers, and so that doesn't really benefit anyone. I think the other problem that I have with this is that, you know, parents and teachers and other, you know, people who are watching over children are responsible for them, not the companies that create material on the internet. We don't really want the internet to be regulated by government. We want it to be a kind of free platform that anyone can use, and parents should be responsible for what their kids are watching. And you know, I say that as a parent myself of three boys who you know, were watching stuff that they shouldn't have been watching, and we tried to police that. There are also safeguards on the internet to try to make sure that children, for example, are not watching pornography or other things that might be harmful to them. But I really worry that once you start regulating this, then the internet will not be the same, and it will be it'll be harder to get material on the internet. And listen, I think we don't want porn. We don't want things that could be harmful to children on the internet, but I'm not so sure that paying, you know, billions of dollars to trial lawyers is the way to solve that problem.
And what about, you know, you have people who've worked for Meta who have subsequently come out and said this was something that the company was actively trying to do, not just provide a service, but provide a service that became addictive and had elements of it designed and specifically made to make people not want to switch off. Does that concern you that there was not just, as you say, that free and open space, but a free and open space that was designed to hold people longer than was healthy for them?
Well, I think this is one of a classic case of individual responsibility versus, what companies are doing. I mean, I remember it wasn't so long ago people were making that claim about, you know, TV shows that, you know, they were addicting kids to watching TV. Now, whose responsibility was it to make sure the kids weren't watching TV? Again, I'd say it was the parents and the guardians of the kids, not the companies making TV shows.
Stephen Moore, thank you for joining us.
It's 21 minutes past eight, and as we've been hearing in our weather forecasts from Stav, for some parts of the country, rain has come. Among those for whom the precipitation has been not just a relief but a necessity is Johnny Crickmore in Suffolk, whose dairy farm received a much-needed downpour overnight.
Last night we had the first rain, proper rain, since May. We recorded 8 mil, which is what I would say is the Goldilocks effect of rain overnight, because it's not too much and it's not too little. So it's a good start. What we really need is the kind of 8 mils to keep happening now for 2 or 3 weeks to start to get things back to growing again.
The disruption to water supplies has hit those like Zara Broadley John, who came to us via BBC Your Voice and lives in the village of Charing in Kent.
We had friends over for a barbecue on Saturday, and it was just after 8 o'clock that evening when we received a text from South East Water to say, you will lose your water supply tonight if you haven't already. And then the water didn't come on until lunchtime, so we were without for the whole of Saturday night through Sunday day and night and into Monday morning. My parents live in an annex in our garden, and my father is bedbound with a number of medical issues, including the use of an indwelling catheter. So it's particularly important that he remains very hydrated. And obviously with the heat wave, that's been more of a challenge. We are really desperate to keep enough water here. We order water from Amazon as and when we can get it. We are on the priority services register, so we do get random deliveries when there are outages, but that causes difficulties because the neighbours think the water's for everyone, and actually it's for my dad. But you shouldn't have to buy water when you pay, you know, a decent amount of money for it to be one of your main utilities.
Well, this morning, South East Water say that supplies have been restored to more than 7,000 properties in Kent, but around 400 homes remain affected by low pressure or no water. They say that levels in its storage tanks for drinking water are still critically low and urge customers to use water only for essential needs. With warnings of a sixth heatwave for southern England, could this rain just be a brief respite for those who've received it? Well, to answer that, as well as she can, is Dr. Ruth Mottram, a climate scientist at the Danish Meteorological Institute, who joins us now. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Mottram. What can we say, and I know that long-range forecasting is fraught with difficulty, but what can we say at this point about what the coming weeks and months might look like?
So it is quite clear that making those kind of predictions is very dangerous if you're not a weather forecaster. So I don't want to make too specific. But when you look at the sort of weather charts that are coming in, it looks like there is some more unsettled rain coming. And of course, the UK is not one country in the sense that the north and the south often have quite different weather patterns. So Scotland looks much wetter. The south of England is still extremely dry, and that doesn't help in generating the rainfall that we need.
Just explain that point, because I think some people might not know about that necessarily, about how the fact that the south of England is so dry means that it is likely to continue to be dry and not necessarily to get more rain.
So one of the problems that we see with these sort of repeated heat waves is that the soil dries out, and we don't tend to think of the soil as a reservoir, but that is actually what it is. It holds the water like a sponge. and then it evaporates during warm weather. And that's not just direct evaporation from the soil, but also all the plants, the trees are sucking water from deep in the soil and then it evaporates. And this is something we typically learn at school. But when you have these very strong blocking high pressures, which typically give these heat waves, enormous amounts of water evaporate from the soil and it just can't it's become self-sustaining to some extent. So then it actually heats up even more because there's no water to evaporate. That evaporation actually cools down the temperature locally. And so now that we have very, very dry soil, and you can see this quite clearly in the satellite pictures over, especially most of England, actually also Wales, northern France, very, very dry. That means that when the conditions would be right to generate local showers, it just can't rain because there isn't any water to evaporate from the soil reservoirs.
Clearly, our climate is changing in quite significant ways. Should we expect a hot, dry summer of the sort that much of the country has experienced this summer to be our new normal?
I think we need to distinguish a little bit between climate and weather. So we can't say that this is going to happen every single year from now on into the future and it's only going to get worse. It is very clear, though, that we need to expect that when we do get a heat wave, it's going to get very hot very quickly. We're going to see this drying out. So we do need to be prepared for increasing stress on water resources in the future. And that's across Europe. I mean, it's also quite interesting that you see that Northern Europe, the UK is particularly hardly hit this year, France, Spain as well. Also Germany, but other parts of Europe haven't been as badly hit. And so it could be that this year it's our turn and then next year it'll be somebody else's turn. But then in a couple of years' time, it'll come back again. So we know that these high pressure systems are sort of blocking highs. It's something that climate models actually disagree on quite a lot if we're going to see more of them in the future. And that's really the weather system that's leading to these very high temperatures and then this drying out of the soil.
And wetter winters as well?
Very likely to be wetter winters, and that's very clear when you look at the temperature of the seawater around Britain and in the North Sea at the moment. It's very, very warm, and that tends to give much wetter storms when the rain finally comes. And most of the rain that we see in Northern Europe does come from the Atlantic. So when those weather systems come in off the Atlantic, they're passing over the sea that's very, very warm. They're picking up more moisture, so we actually expect much more rain when the rain finally arrives.
Okay, Dr. Ruth Mottram, climate scientist at the Danish Meteorological Institute. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
On the way, in the next few minutes, we will speak to a Russian opposition politician who's facing trial in absentia in Moscow. He himself has fled the country as pressure on critics of the Kremlin reaches a new level.
And at 27 minutes past eight, here's Carthy with the sports.
Morning, thank you very much. The opening round of fixtures of the new Championship season came to an end with a dramatic one-all draw between Welsh rivals Cardiff City and Wrexham. A 98th-minute goal from Ruben Colwill salvaged a point for Cardiff City. FIFA's chief operating officer, Kevin Lamour, has been sacked by the sport's governing body less than 3 weeks after he strongly criticised the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino's now aborted plan to sell stakes in the World Cup to private investors. Tennis and Great Britain's Arthur Ferry, playing in his first tournament since reaching the semi-finals at Wimbledon, has been knocked out of the Cincinnati Open in the third round by the fifth seed Alex de Minaur. Serena Williams and Venus Williams played their first doubles match together in 4 years last night, but they lost in a third set tiebreak to Marta Kostyuk and Peyton Stearns in Cincinnati. 44-year-old Serena Williams is back playing competitively, and 45-year-old Roger Federer will be back on court at the US Open next Tuesday, not competitively. The 20-time major champion will play tennis in New York for the first time since 2019 in an exhibition match, before then being inducted into the Tennis Hall of Fame. I've been speaking to Federer's agent, Tony Godzik, about why the 45-year-old wanted to get back on court, and also about the Laver Cup created by Godzik and Roger Federer 10 years ago, and which takes place at the O2 Arena in London next month.
Well, we wanted to create something that tennis didn't have. The Ryder Cup was certainly an inspiration. We saw how popular that was. The Ryder Cup has a 100-year head start on us. One of the things that really inspired Roger and I to create this is we wanted to try to find a way to bring all different generations together. And last year I saw it. It was a moment. I was at Chase Center and I saw Roger talking with Agassi and Yannick Noah. Alcaraz was there, as well as João Fonseca from Brazil. And Rod Laver was kind of off to the side. And I said, that's exactly what we were hoping to do.
I think that's an interesting point. You do get younger players. The interaction, obviously, of the generations is fascinating. But how do you get the players that are already talking about a difficult schedule to then come and play in something like this?
Well, it gives an opportunity for some of these players to actually align themselves with some of the best coaches in the world. I mean, just take last year, Andre Agassi had for sure what was the underdog team, and he found a way to coach these guys to victory. This is a 5-session, 3-day event. They're yearning for something different. This gives a chance for players on Team World and players from Team Europe to get to know each other. It's really important for things to be different, because if things just go on the same way that have gone on for year after year after year, we're not going to be able to compete with other sports.
In this country, there's a lot of talk around sort of Wimbledon and tennis events about the pricing of tickets. With Laver Cup, the tickets are still relatively expensive if you're going as a family. How do you break down those barriers to make sure the families can be able to watch sport and make it accessible?
So we have all different pricing of tickets. I mean, people say they always look at the really premium tickets and say they're expensive, and there are some expensive tickets. But we also have very affordable tickets as well. I don't have to tell you, but England, London in particular, is an incredible tennis market, and we had a great experience here in 22.
And that was when Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal played together. That was Roger Federer's last match. Can you just give us a bit of insight into behind the scenes of something like that, what it was like being there? I know you're Roger Federer's agent as well.
When Roger and I and the whole team created the Laver Cup back in 2016, we never thought, certainly Roger and I never thought it was going to be the site of his retirement. But when he called me right around the championship time in 2022 and said, look, that's it, I'm not going to be able to go anymore. My knees, I've got no more petrol in the knees and stuff like that. I'm like, okay, so where are you going to say goodbye? And he's like, I don't know, what are your ideas? And I said, well, I mean, we can wait a long time, or Laver Cup's coming. And it was beautiful. It was perfect. I mean, to think about it, I don't know how another top player of Roger's stature will ever have the opportunity or ability to retire where his biggest rivals and the biggest stars of the history of the sport on the men's side were there for him. It was perfect.
Speaking of Roger, we've had a 44-year-old Serena Williams back at Wimbledon. Roger Federer will be back on court in New York. How did that come about? I know it's not a competitive match in the same way as Serena Williams' match was.
Yeah, Roger will definitely not be pulling a Serena Williams, but Roger did, after he retired, wanted to make sure his body could heal a little bit and his knees were okay. And I think he misses playing tennis. He doesn't miss the training and the butterflies in his stomach before a big match. But no, the USTA reached out and said, look, Roger, you know, won 5 consecutive US Open titles. We never properly celebrated him. We'd like to do a night where he can play maybe some singles, and that might happen against Andy Roddick, and he'll play some doubles with Roddick and Agassi. And Roger said, yeah, I'd love to do it. So we're super excited. And it ties in with him coming to the States for the Hall of Fame induction. He's really looking forward to it. I know he's been training because he wants to hopefully put on a show. But hopefully it's the start of them doing something like this for all their megastars that played some incredible tennis over the years at the US Open.
Well, it all sounds very exciting. Tony Godsick, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Just a little golf news to finish. LIV Golf has cancelled its team championships in Michigan, saying it needs to focus on building its next chapter. This week's event in Indianapolis will now be the last LIV tournament of the season, with the breakaway league facing an uncertain financial future.
Thank you, Kathy. There is another classic American drama for you to enjoy this weekend.
Radio 4's Story of America.
New York City, please welcome Joe Buck.
The first ever audio adaptation of Midnight Cowboy.
Say, I'm new in town, looking for the Statue of Liberty.
You for real? Watch it, cowboy.
Go on, get out of here.
Dreams, desperation, and an unlikely friendship.
You know, I don't like anything to do with stolen money.
Well, then you won't have anything to do with eating tonight either.
Midnight Cowboy.
No one's gonna stop us this time! We're getting out!
Begins on Sunday at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Henry Zeffman. And at 27 minutes to 9, a summary of the news from Charles Carroll.
A jury trial is set to get underway in California today, in which 30 US states will accuse Meta of deliberately designing some of its platforms to be addictive to young users. If the technology giant loses, it may have to pay upwards of $1 trillion in damages. Meta strongly denies the allegations. Stephen Moore, who's a former economic advisor to President Donald Trump, told us Meta was being targeted because it had deep pockets. Russia has threatened the UK with consequences after Ukraine used British-made drones to strike targets inside Russia. Britain says it's committed to providing the equipment Ukraine needs to defend itself. The unemployment rate remained at 4.9% between April and June, according to the latest figures from the Office for National Statistics. The number of job vacancies is at its lowest level in more than 5 years, as smaller businesses cut back on recruitment. And West Yorkshire police say that Lee Ellis, who's 55, has been charged with manslaughter over the death of another man who was bitten by a German shepherd. The incident happened on a footpath in Wakefield on Saturday.
Thank you, Charles. Just coming round to 25 to 9 now. One of Russia's prominent anti-war politicians, Lev Schlossberg, has been sentenced to more than 11 years in a penal colony, accused of discrediting the country's armed forces and spreading false information about them, or so the charge read. He's condemned that verdict and the efforts that the Russian administration is making to stop Pizya Bloko party taking part in next month's parliamentary elections. And that crackdown by the Russian leadership on dissidents is a broad one. Later today, Boris Nadezhdin, who ran against Vladimir Putin in the 2024 presidential election on an anti-war platform, will be tried in absentia in Moscow. You might remember we heard from him on the programme a few weeks ago when he was designated a foreign agent. Well, he's now left the country for his own safety. And I spoke to him again this morning about his decision to do that.
The choice to leave to exile connected with the criminal prosecution in Russia because I was accused for violation of law connected with extremism. Of course, I'm not extremist or terrorist, but some of my interview, some of my post was made by Russian prosecutors like criminal cases. And so I was submitted by the paper from investigative committee. It is a governmental body responsible for criminal investigations on Friday 22. And my lawyer said me that I have just 1 or 2 days to leave the Russia.
Even though you're not in Russia anymore, your trial is still happening today. It's going ahead without you. What do you believe and fear the result of that might be?
The thing is, I have so many trials in courts last week or some next week that I forgot about this trial. But of course, my lawyer will be in this trial, and this trial is connected with my interview for Medusa. Medusa is a Russian language mass media, which is a nonsense, like not a good organization in terms of Russian law. And if you connect with this organization, such as Medusa mass media, just say a few words for them, it for the first time it's an administrative violation, and so the fee, big fee. And second time it's a criminal case. And so today really. Court in Moscow will decide about my case, and my lawyers will be in this court. And frankly speaking, I have no idea. I have no doubt about this decision of this court, because I have already had some of these decisions last few weeks.
You have expressed your political opinions in Russia for years now, for decades. Is this the worst time that you can remember for expressing opinions that differ to that of President Putin?
Unfortunately, the situation is coming worse and worse and worse. For example, 2 years before, in 24, I was running for presidential election, and I have received a very big support from people all over the Russia, thousands of people. I have just two messages. Message number one, the war should be stopped. And message number two, Putin should go away from presidential post. Of course, I was not allowed to be in ballot. Of course, I was banned from presidential election. But there were no repressions. There were no strong pressure, no criminal cases about me, etc. But now situation has changed dramatically, because it concerns me personally and it concerns the Yabloko party. Now it is absolutely impossible to criticize the war if you are running in campaign.
You said there that you can no longer be in Russian politics, but right now you can no longer be in Russia at all, in your home country. Now you've left, do you believe that your life is safe?
Anyway, it's much better to be in Paris than to be in jail Lefortovo. My lawyer said me that if I would go to the investigative committee on Friday, 24 July, 99% that from this investigative committee I would be taken to the court and court will decide to go meet to take me in Lefortovo. It's a jail. This way is a frequent way for political activists in Russia. Investigative committees and courts and Lefortovo. And so I think it's much better to be in even in the hotel in Paris than in jail Lefortovo. In this sense, of course, I suppose I'm now in safety. But I have a lot of problems because of my exile from Russia, because first of all, I have my family. I have four children, and two of them are really children, 12 and 15 years, and they are now with my wife in Dolgoprudny, is the city. Dolgoprudny is a place where we live many, many years, and I have very old parents, about 90 years, and it's not obvious what will be with my natives and my family. And second, I don't know what will be the decisions of courts about me, because next few weeks I have three courses minimum. One thing, if I will be declared as criminal, violator of criminal law, it's one situation. Other situation, if I will not have the criminal decision about me. And these two situations with family and with courts may influence on my further decision to be in the West or to return to Moscow, etc., etc.
Boris Nadezhdin, thank you for joining us this morning.
It's 19 minutes to nine. Workers at Britain's newest prison have described to the BBC a chaotic atmosphere, with understaffing and those staff who are there having received inadequate training. HMP Millsike opened near York in 2025, and the government said it would set the standard for jails for the future. But a specialist team, which deals with the most serious incidents, was called to Millsike seven times in its first 9 months, which Mighty, the firm that runs Millsike, says was in line with expectations. So how common are these kinds of issues at new prisons? Pia Sinner is chief executive of the Prison Reform Trust, which campaigns to improve conditions in prisons, and pleased to say, joins us now. Is what's described in this BBC investigation what you'd expect from a new prison?
Yes. Good morning, Henry. I would say that, yes, absolutely. I think that if you take the example of other large prisons that have opened in the last decade or so, Berwyn being a very big example. It was a prison that opened as a Titan prison in North Wales in 2018, I think. It operated in half capacity for nearly 2 years because there was an absolute acceptance in the service that when you open up a new prison, you have to ramp it up gradually so that, you know, the expertise can be built in running the jail rather than fill it and flood it with prisoners just when it opens.
And this is a Category C prison, which means Right. that it houses inmates assessed as a low to moderate security risk. Does that affect some of the issues that are described in this investigation?
Well, I think the Category C prison bit is slightly misleading. Currently, because of the capacity crisis, people are moving into Category C conditions quicker than they might normally have done because there's a lot of pressure within the local estate to get spaces. And so that means that rather than have a period of stability in those local places where they can get assessed and stabilized and then move to Cat C prisons, they're moving as soon as possible in order to, alleviate the capacity crisis.
Right. And the Prison Reform Trust, which you run, has an advice and information line open to prisoners. I understand that it did hear from some prisoners at Millsike.
Correct. That's right. We did get a number of calls from prisoners from Millsike, and they were concerning. And we had to raise safeguarding concerns with the prison. And it was at times slightly difficult to get hold of the prison. But when we did, the prison were responsive. So it wasn't that our concerns were not being addressed or listened to. But it took time. And I think it's important to say that the public underestimate how complex prison leadership is. There are all types of risks that you have to manage. There's several moving parts. And sometimes it's easy for us as armchair experts to be critical. I mean, I'm 6 years out of governing now, and things have become so much more complex even in that time. So we do need to cut them a bit of slack and give them time to operationally stabilize.
Complex in what way, by the way? What way have they become more complex in that time?
Because you've got a challenging group of prisoners. So, you know, you're holding the country's most challenging individuals in a confined space. And if that space is overcrowded, that poses risks. If you've got a staffing group that are inexperienced and need to learn jailcraft, it takes time. And don't forget, Mighty are a private prison who don't have other prisons yet. They have considerable experience in the IRC sector, but not in prisons. So they can't turn to their colleagues in other prisons and say, can I have some mutual aid? Can you give me some experienced staff so I can get the ratio right? And so when you have the combination of complex prisoners working with inexperienced staff, that is a high-risk situation, and that has to be managed very carefully and safely. And it's fine that you have the operational response and resilience unit coming in to kind of go in when things have gone wrong, but the support needs to be given, the mutual aid needs to be given much early on in recognition of the fact that these things happen and accept that these risks have to be managed.
Okay. Pia Sinha, Chief Executive of the Prison Reform Trust, former prison governor, appreciate you giving us that context. And we should just add, Mighty, the company which runs HMP Millsike, as mentioned, said safety was its highest priority and that it was operating in line with plans agreed with the Ministry of Justice.
It's 14 minutes to nine. The parents of more than 30 children, nearly all of them from the UK, have told the BBC they suspect that they were given the wrong sperm or egg donors during IVF treatments in northern Cyprus. It's one of the most popular destinations for British people who are seeking fertility treatment, but a growing number have found out that their children are likely to be unrelated to the donor that the parents chose and paid for. They got in touch after a File on 4 documentary, Sunshine and Secrets, The Hidden Side of IVF, exposed the problems behind the glossy clinic websites earlier this year. Beth, who's a mum of two children, both conceived through IVF, described in that documentary how she and her partner Laura felt when DNA tests revealed that their two children did not appear to be biologically related to each other.
The feelings of dread and the sinking feeling in my stomach was very much around knowing that what we had asked to happen through the IVF process had not happened. Something had gone very much amiss. And what was that going to mean for the children?
Well, Dr. Hippocrates Saris is chair-elect of the British Fertility Society, a consultant in reproductive medicine and director at the King's Fertility Clinic in London. Good morning.
Good morning.
This sort of thing, as you could hear there, as we heard from Beth, is a real concern to potential parents who are going through this treatment in northern Cyprus.
Well, it's absolutely devastating and appalling, to be perfectly honest. As a clinician in the UK, this would never be something that would happen. A one-off mistake is possible, but what seems to be happening here, this is not just simply a failure of an individual clinic, a doctor, or the donor screening. This seems to be a systemic issue with that particular destination, which is, as you said, very popular with UK would-be parents.
Why would it be that a clinic would decide to not give the donor sperm or donor egg that a person had chosen? Is it to do with bad record keeping? Is it financial? I'm curious as to the reasons behind it.
Well, first of all, there should be absolutely no medical reason to do that. There are, of course, reasons where we might not use a donor because they're known to have a genetic condition, for example. But that would be something that would be very open and transparent to the patients and the parents, and it wouldn't be a secret. Beyond that, you're absolutely right. There can potentially be an error. Of course, there are a lot of systems in place in modern fertility treatment, so these are not happening. And it's not just for donor-conceived individuals, but also for people having treatment with their own eggs and sperm. So maybe potentially I can understand one-off mistake. But when it happens so frequently, so systematically, clearly over years, that seems to be a bit more purposeful, and possibly it shows deceit or negligence, to say the least. So it's clearly there's no rational explanation before beyond something which is either commercial, as you said, or just absolutely appalling clinical sort of care, which it shouldn't be the case at all anywhere in the world, let alone in fertility care.
And what are the rules like in Northern Cyprus? Presumably the rules are different to the ones that we have here.
Well, this is quite fascinating because I did actually review the rules of Northern Cyprus as a territory, and they're very, very similar to what we have in the UK. If anything, it seems like they might have actually lifted and shifted a lot of our legislation. So it doesn't seem to be an issue of legislation, but of enforcement of that particular sort of rules, and have accountability that if there are mistakes or negligence or deceit, that actually doesn't go unpunished, and therefore people won't do it again.
What advice would you give to prospective parents in a situation like this? Because, as we said, it is a popular destination. It's one that often people will go to because they've been referred to, sometimes as a financial element because fertility treatment is expensive. What would you say to people who are considering it now?
I think it's very, very difficult because if it was just a one-off clinical error, I'd say do your due diligence, make sure you speak to the doctors and the clinicians involved. In this particular case, it seems that a lot of these parents were lied to, and even when they were confronted with the truth, they still lied. So I think, unfortunately, for the time being, until the ministry of the particular territory steps up and cleans up the act, I would say they probably should avoid having treatments in areas where literally you can't trust that what they're telling you is truthful.
No. And what you can actually do yourself, and you talk there about due diligence, about speaking to the staff, but ultimately you have no idea. There's nothing that you can practically do to check that you're getting what you were expecting.
Unfortunately, no. I mean, the bond of trust between a patient and a doctor is the most sacred bond. At the end of the day, you can do as much of due diligence as you can possibly do, but you have to trust the clinician and the clinic. And if that trust is broken, then unfortunately, not something that you can mend easily. So I think in this particular situation, I would avoid until everything is cleared up.
It's useful advice. Dr. Hippocrates Saris, Chair-elect of the British Fertility Society. Thank you.
It's 9 minutes to nine. Name Zefman, Henry Zefman. Yes, auditions to become the next James Bond are underway, with Amazon, who have taken over control of the franchise, promising they will have selected their 007 by the end of the year. They say the new double agent will be stirring, exciting, and different. Well, we're holding our own Bond auditions here and asked stars what makes them qualified to be the new Bond. Hearing from the next generation, like YouTuber Max Fosh, but also the much-loved actor and impressionist John Culshaw.
If I was to have a go with the James Bond character, I'd be tempted to bring a blend of Bonds together to really wrong-foot the villains and then bring in a curveball at the end. Sean Connery, Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan.
James Bond. James Bond. Vodka martini, shaken, not stirred.
License to kill, though I think Scaramanga wants to put me into the wrong franchise, and so automatically I become a Time Lord. Yes, James Bond versus Goldfinger and the Daleks. What an amusing afternoon that would be. BBC Radio 4, just as I thought. Most impressive, Mr. Bond.
Hello, my name is Max Fosh. I can't confirm nor deny whether I myself am going to be seen for it. I have signed an NDA, and so I definitely cannot tell you whether I am going to be seen in it. I think they just want Bond to go in a slightly more younger direction, really, you know, slight YouTube direction, just doing a mukbang with Q, get ready with me. I think they're just looking to appeal to a younger audience, I think, with Bond. And so I'm really excited to be seen for the role. Sorry, actually, I can't confirm nor deny whether I am going to be seen for the role. But yeah, there's lots of opportunity with vlogger Bond, I think.
Hello, Today programme. It's me, comedian and actor, Chloe Petz. I think that I come from quite an underrepresented community in the Bond arena, and I would like to offer some representation in that I come from the community of people that are quite slow, uncharismatic, not a very good shot and don't like martinis. So if they're looking for something different, I think I would be perfect for the role. I think it would be a bit like, you know, when people say that just a normal person should do all of the Olympic sports next to the Olympians to show how masterful they are at what they do. I think it would be a bit like that. Just get like a normal sort of chubby person just playing 007. So yeah, I would like to throw my hat in the ring to be Bond, James Bond. Was that right? I'm shaken and stirred.
As are we all. Some passionate auditions there. We'll find out who the next Bond will be before the end of the year, as we were hearing there. Now, let us look ahead to, just in a few minutes' time, actually, David Dimbleby will be telling the little-known story of Walt Rostow, an academic whose idealistic theories led to the disastrous Vietnam War. That is Invisible Hands, the American Century, and it's on the way here on Radio 4 just after 9.
Yeah, I've listened to that already on BBC Sounds. It's fascinating. But at 6 minutes to nine, when 88-year-old Mick Wodge's wife, Margaret, died shortly after their 60th wedding anniversary, he responded to finding himself on his own after so long by taking up weightlifting. He began with a broom handle and milk containers, but it quickly escalated. Here's a little taste of Mick talking about his training.
Every day is a challenge. It's sad, isn't it? Well, it's what keeps me going. You know, that's the whole point of it, the challenge. Getting up in the morning, getting ready, you're on your own. If the wife had been alive, I wouldn't have been in here. I'd have been busy taking her out.
Well, Mick's personal trainer, Ross Starkey, set up a TikTok account for him about 4 weeks ago, since when the videos have amassed about 700,000 views. And both Mick and Ross join us now. Good morning, gents.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, Mick, let's start with you. Just run us through your routine. How many times a week are you training and what are you lifting?
Well, I do 4 sessions a week, Monday, Wednesday and Friday. And Tuesday, I'm coached by Ross. We do like about an hour and a half. And we do go through all the weightlifting situation. It changes as we go along. We deadlift, we bench press, we use the machines, and it's a full workout. So when we've finished, they carry me out and put me in my car.
And it says here, Mick, I doubt you're being carried out, because it says here that your personal best for a deadlift is 100 kilograms. Is that right?
No.
Yeah, you did once.
No, we did 110.
Oh, OK. Sorry, I'm understating your achievements.
Hey, he's trying to knock them down here. we did 110. And one of my targets was the deadlift, because I talked to a friend of mine who's 77, is it?
77, yeah.
77. I talked him into coming, and they went and lifted 120 on the deadlift. So that was my challenge, and I haven't been able to reach it. I've fallen out with him now.
I'm sure it's just a matter of days, if not even hours, after the motivation of having told that story on Radio 4. Ross, give us a sense of what it is like training somebody who is a little older, 88 in Mick's case. Are there particular challenges that you need to be aware of?
Well, I think this is the issue where a lot of people are doing it wrong. They treat old people like old people, and I've never treated Mick like that. I've never changed his training. That's why he's able to do what he can do. People are so scared of hurting old people that they don't ever challenge them, and then they never grow. And then you see him with these little plastic weights and these rubber bands. And Mick's older than a lot of these people, and he's deadlifting 100 kilograms of ease. But this is a journey, what we've done over 3 years to get him to this point.
You said 100 again, Ross. I think it's 110. I just want to correct you before Mick does. But
yeah,
tell me,
what
are the benefits for people?
I'm going to smack him when he's finished.
You can do that after nine. What are the benefits for people, Ross, who are training when they're older in terms of their lifestyle at that stage of life?
I think one of the most important things is bone density. As you get older, your bone density starts to decay. But you can actually prevent that with heavy strength training. So if Mick was to fall over, he's not going to like break an ankle or a bone. He's really robust now. So if he falls over, I can get back up. Well, if old people don't do strength training, you know, falling over can be a death sentence, unfortunately.
And Mick, you've been praised online by, well, countless people who've seen the TikTok account, but no less than Arnold Schwarzenegger, who said he loved what you're doing. Keep pumping. I'm not going to do an impression. Tell me, what does it mean to get praise like that as you set yourself the challenge of beating your friend's personal best?
Well, it's just amazing. I mean, Arnold was my favourite bodybuilder years ago. I've seen every one of his films dozens of times. And for him to contact us like that, it's just amazing. I mean, it's well worth all the effort I've put in just for what Arnold's done. He sent